Birds? No, they were too big to be seabirds, and none would be out in this weather anyway. The black dots were coming toward her. They were closer now, resolving, no longer dots. She could see them for what they were. Riders. Four riders cloaked in glimmering bronze. They hurtled through the sky like comets. They were not a wild hunt. Emma knew that immediately, without knowing how she knew it. There were too few of them, and they were too silent. The wild hunt rode with a fierce clamor. The bronze riders glided silently toward Emma, as if they had been formed out of the clouds. She could run back toward the cottage, she thought, but that would draw them toward Julian, and besides, they had angled themselves to cut her off from the path back to Malcolm's house. They were moving with incredible speed. In seconds, they would be on the cliff. Her right hand closed on the hilt of Cortana. She drew it almost without conscious thought. The feeling of it in her hand grounded her, slowed her heartbeat. They soared overhead, circling. For a moment, Emma was struck by their odd beauty. Up close, the horses seemed barely real, as transparent as glass, formed out of the wisps of cloud and moisture. They spun in the air and dove like gulls after their prey. As their hooves struck the solid earth of the cliff, they exploded into ocean whitecaps, each horse a spray of vanishing water, leaving the four riders behind. And between Emma and the path, she was cut off from everything but the sea and the small piece of cliff behind her. The four riders faced her. She braced her feet. The very top of the ridge was so narrow that her boots sank into either side of the cliff's spine. She raised Cortana. It flashed in the stormlight, rain sliding off its blade. "Who's there?" she called. The four figures moved as one, reaching to push back the hoods of their bronze cloaks. Beneath was more shining stuff. They were three tall men and a woman, each of them wearing bronze half-masks, with hair that looked like metallic thread wound into thick braids that hung halfway down their backs. Their armor was metal, breastplates and gauntlets etched all over with the designs of waves and the sea. The eyes they fixed on her were gray and piercing.
"Emma Cordelia Carstairs," said one of them.
He spoke as if Emma's name were in a foreign language, one his tongue had a hard time wrapping itself around.
"Well met."
"In your opinion," Emma muttered. She kept a tight grip on Cortana. Each one of the fairies, for she knew they were fairies, that she was facing was armed with a longsword, hilts visible over the shoulders. She raised her voice.
"What does this convoy from the fairy court want from me?"
The fairy raised an eyebrow.
"Tell her, fowl," said one of the others in the same accented voice.
Something about the accent raised the hairs on Emma's arms, though she couldn't have said what it was.
"We are riders of Manon," said Fowl. "You will have heard of us."
It wasn't a question. Emma desperately wished Christina were with her. Christina was the one with vast knowledge of fairy culture. If the words riders of Manon were supposed to mean something to shadow hunters, Christina would know it.
"Are you part of the wild hunt?" she asked.
Consternation. A low mutter vibrated among the four of them, and Fowl leaned to the side and spat. A fairy with a sharply chiseled jaw and an expression of disdain replied for him.
"I am Iomed, son of Manon," he said. "We are the children of a god, you see. We are much older than the wild hunt and much more powerful."
Emma realized then what it was that she'd heard in their accents. It wasn't distance or foreignness. It was age. A terrifying age that stretched back to the beginning of the world.
"We seek," said Fowl, "and we find. We are searchers. We have been under the waves to search and above them. We have been in faery and in the realms of the damned and on the battlefields and in the dark of night and the bright of day. In all our lives,
There has only been one thing we have sought and not found.
A sense of humor, Emma suggested.
She should shut her mouth, said the female rider. You should shut it for her, Fal.
Not yet, Ethna, said Fal. We need her words. We need to know the location of what we seek.
Emma's hand felt hot and slippery on the hilt of Cortana. What do you seek?
The Black Volume, said Iomed. We seek the same object you and your Parabatai seek, the one taken by Annabel Blackthorne.
Emma took an involuntary step back.
You're looking for Annabel?
For the book, said the fourth rider, his voice harsh and deep. Tell us where it is, and we will leave you be.
I don't have it, said Emma. Neither does Julian.
She is a liar, Delon, said the woman, Ethna.
His lips curled.
They are all liars, Nephilim. Do not treat us as fools, Shadow Hunter, or we will string your innards from the nearest tree.
Try it, said Emma. I'll ram the tree down your throat until the branches start poking out your ears.
It was Julian. He must have applied a soundless rune, because even Emma hadn't heard him approach. He was perched on a wet boulder by the sides of the path toward the cottage, as if he'd simply appeared there, summoned out of the rain and clouds. He was in gear, his hair wet, an unlit seraph blade in his hand.
I'm sure you were going to say ears.
Definitely.
Emma grinned at him. She couldn't help it. Despite the fight they'd had, he was here, having her back, being her Parabatai. And now they had the riders hemmed in, pinned between the two of them. Things were looking up.
Julian Blackthorne, drawled Fal, barely glancing at him. The famous Parabatai. I hear the two of you gave a most impressive performance at the Unseelie Court.
I'm sure the king couldn't stop singing our praises, Julian said. Look, what makes you think we know where Annabel or the Black Volume are?
Spies are in every court, said Ethna. We know the queen sent you to find the book. The king must have it before the queen possesses it.
But we have promised the queen, said Julian, and a promise like that cannot be broken.
Delon growled, his hand suddenly at the hilt of his sword. He had moved so fast it was a blur.
You are humans, liars, he said. You can break any promise you make, and will when your necks are on the line, as they are now.
He jerked his chin toward the cottage.
We have come for the warlock's books and papers. If you will not tell us anything, then give them to us, and we will be gone.
Give them to you? Julian looked puzzled. Why didn't you just...
His eyes met Emma's. She knew what he was thinking. Why didn't they break in and take them?
You can't get in, can you?
The wards, Emma confirmed.
The fairies said nothing, but she could tell by the angry set of their jaws that she was right.
What will the Unseelie King give us in return for the book? Said Julian.
Jewels, Emma hissed. How could he be scheming at a time like this?
Fal laughed. Emma noted for the first time that the clothes and the armor of the fairies were dry, as if the rain didn't fall on them. His glance toward Julian was full of contempt.
You have no advantage here, son of thorns. Give us what we came for, or when we find the rest of your family, we shall put red-hot pokers through their eyes, down even to the smallest child.
Tavi. The words went through Emma like an arrow. She felt the impact, felt her body jerk, and the cold came down over her, the cold ice of battle.
She lunged for Fal, bringing Cortana down in a vicious overhand swipe. Ethna screamed, and Fal moved faster than a current on the ocean, ducking Emma's blow. Cortana whistled through the air. There was a clamor as the other fairies reached for their swords, and a glow as Julian's seraph blade burst into light, illuminating the rain. It wove around Emma like bright strings as she twirled, fending off a blow from Ethna, Cortana slamming into the fairy sword with enough force to send Ethna stumbling back. Fal's face twisted with surprise.
Emma gasped, wet, inhaling rain but not feeling the cold. The world was a spinning gray top. She ran toward one of the stone spires and clambered up it.
Coward! Iomed cried. How dare you run away?
Emma heard Julian laugh as she reached the top of the spire and leapt from it. The descent gave her speed, and she slammed into Iomed with enough force to knock him to the ground. He tried to roll away, but froze when she smashed the hilt of Cortana into his temple. He choked with pain.
Shut up, Emma hissed. Don't you dare touch the Blackthorns. Don't you even talk about them. Let him be, Ethna called, and Delon leapt toward them, only to be stopped by Julian and the sweep of his seraph blade.
The cliff exploded with light, the rain seeming to hang still in the air, as the blade swung down and slammed against the fairy warrior's breastplate.
And shattered.
It broke as if it had been made out of ice, and Julian was thrown back by the recoiling force of it, lifted off his feet and slammed down among the rocks and wet earth.
Delon laughed, striding toward Julian. Emma abandoned Iomed where he lay and leapt after the fairy warrior as he raised his sword over Jules and brought it down.
Julian rolled fast to the right, swung around, and drove a dagger into the unguarded skin of Delon's calf. Delon yelled with pain and anger, spinning to drive the tip of the sword down toward Julian's body. But Jules had flung himself upward. He was on his feet, dagger in hand. Light shafted down suddenly through the clouds, and Emma saw the shadows on the ground before her shift. There was someone behind her. She spun away just as a blade came down, barely missing her shoulder. She spun around to find Ethna behind her. Fowl was leaning over Iomed on the ground, helping haul him to his feet. For a moment it was just Emma and the fairy woman, and Emma grabbed the hilt of Cortana with both hands and swung. Ethna darted back, but she was laughing.
You, Nephilim, she sneered. You call yourselves warriors, ringed round with your protective runes, your angel blades. Without them you would be nothing, and you will be without them soon enough. You will be nothing, and we will take everything from you. Everything you have. Everything.
Did you want to say that again? Emma asked, evading a slice of Ethna's sword with a twist of her body.
She leapt up onto a boulder, looking down. The everything part? I don't think I got it the first time.
Ethna snarled and leapt for her, and for a long series of movements it was only the battle, the glowing vapor of the rain, the sea crashing and thundering in the pools below the cliff. And everything slowed down as Emma knocked Ethna to the side and leapt for Iomed and Fowl, her sword clanging against theirs. They were good, better than good, fast, and blindingly strong. But Cortana was like having a living thing in Emma's hands. Rage powered her, an electric current that shot through her veins, driving the sword in her hand, hammering the blade against those raised against hers, the clang of metal drowning out the sea. She tasted salt in her mouth, blood or ocean spray, she didn't know. Her wet hair whipped around her as she spun, Cortana meeting the other swords of the fairies, blow after blow. An ugly laugh cut through the violent dream that gripped her. She looked up to see that Fowl had Julian backed up to the edge of the cliff. It fell away, sheer, behind him. He stood framed against the gray sky, his hair plastered darkly to his head. Panic blasted through her. She pushed off from the side of a granite facing with a kick that connected solidly against Iomed's body. The fairy fell back with a grunt, and Emma was racing, seeing Julian in her mind's eye run through with a sword, or toppled from the cliff's edge to shatter on the rocks, or drown in the maelstrom below. Fowl was laughing. He had his sword out. Julian took another step backward, and ducked down, swift and nimble, to catch up a crossbow from where it had been hidden behind a tumble of rocks. He lifted it to his shoulder just as Emma collided with Fowl, her sword out. She didn't slow, didn't pause, just slammed Cortana point first between Fowl's shoulder blades. It pierced his armor and slid home. She felt the point burst out of the other side of his body, slicing through the metal breastplate. There was a shriek from behind Emma. It was Ethna. She had her head thrown back, her hands clawing at her hair. She was wailing in a language Emma didn't know, but she could hear that Ethna was shrieking her brother's name.
Fowl! Fowl!
Ethna began to sink to her knees. Delon reached to catch her, his own face bone white and shocked. With a roar, Iarmed lifted his sword and lunged toward Emma, who was struggling to free Cortana from Fowl's limp body. She tensed and pulled. The sword came free with a gout of blood, but she had no time to turn. Julian released the bolt from his crossbow. It whistled through the air, a softer sound than the rain, and struck the sword in Iarmed's hand, knocking it out of his grip. Iarmed howled. His hand was scarlet. Emma turned, planted her feet, raised her sword. Blood and rain ran down Cortana's blade.
"Who wants to try me?"
she shouted, her words half torn out of her mouth by wind and water.
"Who wants to be next?" "Let me kill her,"
Ethna struggled in Delon's grip.
"She slew Fowl. Let me cut her throat."
But Delon was shaking his head. He was saying something, something about Cortana. Emma took a step forward. If they wouldn't come to her to be killed, she would be happy enough to go to them. Iarmed raised his hand. She saw light flicker from his fingers, pale green in the gray air. His face twisted in a sneer of concentration.
"Emma!"
Jules caught her from behind before she could take another step, hauling her back and against him just as the rain exploded into the shapes of three horses, swirling creatures of wind and spray, snorting and pawing at the air between Emma and the rest of the riders. Fowl lay with his blood soaking into the Cornwall dirt as his brothers and sister vaulted onto the bare backs of their steeds. Emma began to shiver violently. Only one of the riders paused long enough to look back at her before their horses shot forward into the sky, losing themselves in the clouds and rain. It was Ethna. Her eyes were murderous, disbelieving.
"You have slain an ancient and primitive thing," her gaze seemed to say. "Be prepared for a vengeance just as ancient, just as primitive."
"Run," Livy said. It was the last thing Kit had expected. Shadowhunters didn't run. That was what he'd always been told. But Livy took off like a bullet out of a gun, flashing past the rider on the path in front of her, and Ty followed. Kit ran after them. They tore past the ferries and into the throng of pedestrians on the Thames path. Kit pulled alongside Livy and Ty, though he was breathing hard and they weren't. He could hear thunder behind him, hoofbeats. "We can't outrun them," he thought, but he didn't have the breath to say it. The leaden gray air felt heavy as he pulled it into his lungs. Livy's dark hair streamed on the wind as she flung herself over a gate set into the railing separating the path from the river. For a moment she seemed to hang suspended in the air, her arms upraised, her coat flapping, and then she soared straight down, vanishing out of sight. And Ty followed her, vaulting sideways over the gate, disappearing as he fell. "Into the river," Kit thought hazily, but he didn't pause. His muscles were already beginning the now familiar burning, his mind tightening and focusing. He grabbed hold of the top of the gate and pushed himself up and over it. He fell only a few feet to land in a crouch on a cement platform that stretched out into the Thames, surrounded by a low iron railing that was broken in several places. Ty and Livy were already there, jackets yanked off to free their arms, serif blades in hand. Livy tossed a short sword toward Kit as he straightened up, realizing why she'd run. Not to get away, but to clear them some space to fight. And hopefully to contact the Institute. Ty had his phone out in his hand, was thumbing at the keyboard even as he raised his serif blade, its light bursting dully against the clouds. Kit turned just as the three riders sailed over the gate to join them, flashing bronze and gold as they landed. Their swords whipped free with blinding speed.
"Stop him!"
snarled Karn, and his two brothers launched themselves at Ty. Livy and Kit moved as one to throw themselves in front of Tiberius. The cold, hard blur of fighting was on Kit, but the riders were faster than demons, and stronger, too. Kit whipped his short sword toward Eocade, but the fairy was no longer there. He'd leapt all the way to the far side of the platform. He laughed at the expression on Kit's face, even as a Tarlem slashed out with a blow that knocked the phone out of Ty's hand. It skittered across the concrete and splashed into the river. A shadow fell over Kit. He responded instantaneously, driving upward with a short sword. He heard a gasp, and Karn fell back, dark drops of blood spattering on the ground at his feet. Kit flung himself up and forward, lunging for Eoke, but Livy and Ty were ahead of him, blurs of light as their seraph blades cut the air around the riders. But only the air. Kit couldn't help but notice the angel blades didn't seem to be cutting through the rider's armor, or even slicing their skin as he'd managed to do with a short sword. There was puzzlement on Ty's face, rage on Livy's as she stabbed at Eochaid's heart with her seraph blade. The weapon snapped off at the hilt, the force of the rebound sending her staggering back almost into the river. Ty whipped around as he looked after her. Eochaid raised his sword and brought it down in a sweeping arc toward Ty, and Kit lunged across the platform, knocking Tiberius flat. Ty's blade went flying, splashing down into the Thames, sending up a flurry of fiery droplets. Kit had landed half across Ty, banging his head hard on a jutting piece of wood. He felt Ty tried to shove him off, and rolled over to see Eochaid standing over them both. Livy had engaged the two other riders, was fighting them desperately, a whirl of flashing weaponry, but she was on the other side of the platform. Kit fought to get his breath back, raised his sword. Eochaid stood arrested, his eyes glittering behind the holes of his mask. The irises, too, were bronze-colored.
"I know you," he said. "I know your face."
Kit gaped at him. A second later, Eochaid was raising his sword, mouth twisting into a grin, and a shadow fell over them all. The rider looked up, astonishment crossing his face, as a burly arm reached down from above and seized hold of him. A second later, he was flying up into the air, yelling. Kit heard a splash. The rider had been tossed into the river. Kit struggled to sit up, Ty beside him. Livy had turned to face them, her mouth open, but the riders were similarly agape, their swords dangling by their sides as a thunderous, whirling mass landed in the center of the platform. It was a horse, and on the horse's back was Gwyn, massive in his helmet and bark-like armor. It was his gauntleted arm that had flung Eochaid into the river, but now the rider had swum back to the platform and was climbing onto it, his movement slowed by his heavy armor. Clinging to the man's waist was Diana, her dark hair a mass of curls, pulling free of their restraints, her eyes wide. Ty got to his feet. Kit scrambled up after him. There was some blood staining the collar of Ty's hoodie. Kit realized he didn't know if it was Ty's or his own.
"Riders," Gwyn said in a thunderous voice.
There was a wide cut across his arm where Eochaid must have gotten in a blow.
"Stop!"
Diana slid from the horse's back and stalked across the concrete platform to where Eochaid was clambering out of the water. She unhitched her sword from its scabbard, spun it, and pointed it directly at his chest.
"Don't move," she said.
The rider subsided, his teeth bared in a silent snarl.
"This is none of your concern, Gwyn," said Karn. "This is unseelie business."
"The Wild Hunt bends to no law," said Gwyn. "Our will is the wind's will, and my will now is to send you away from these children. They are under my protection."
"They are Nephilim," spat Itarlum. "The architects of the Cold Peace, vicious and cruel."
"You are no better," said Gwyn. "You are the king's hunting dogs, and never have you shown any mercy."
Karn and Itarlum stared at Gwyn. Eochaid kneeling dripped on the concrete. A moment stretched out like rubber, seemingly extending forever. Eochaid shot suddenly to his feet with a gasp, seemingly heedless of Diana's sword, tracking him unerringly as he moved.
"Thal,"
he said.
"He is dead."
"That is impossible," said Karn. "Impossible. A rider cannot die."
But Itarlum let out a loud, keening cry, his sword falling to the ground as his hand flew to cover his heart.
"He is gone," he wailed. "I feel it. Our brother is gone."
"A rider," has passed into the Shadowlands, said Gwyn. Would you like me to sound the horn for him?
Though Gwyn had sounded sincere enough to Kit, Eochaid snarled and made as if to lunge for the hunter, but Diana's sword kissed his throat as he moved, drawing blood. Thick, dark drops ran down her blade.
Enough, said Karn. Gwyn, you will pay for this treachery. Etar, Eochaid, to my side. We go to our brothers and sister.
Diana lowered her sword as Eochaid shouldered past her, joining the other two riders. They leapt from the platform into the air, long, soaring leaps that took them high above, where they caught the manes of their gleaming bronze horses and swung themselves up to ride. As they hurtled past above the water, Eochaid's voice echoed in Kit's ringing ears.
I know you. I know your face.
Emma was shaking by the time they got back to the cottage. A combination of cold and reaction had set in. Her hair and clothes were plastered to her, and she suspected she looked like a drowned rat. She propped Cortana against the wall and began wearily to shuck off her drenched jacket and shoes. She was aware of Julian locking the door behind them, aware of the sounds of him moving around the room. Warmth, too. He must have built up a fire earlier. A moment later, something soft was being pressed into her hands. Julian stood in front of her, his expression unreadable, offering a slightly worn bath towel. She took it and began to dry off her hair. Jules was still wearing his damp clothes, though he was barefoot and he'd thrown on a dry sweater. Water gleamed at the edges of his hair, the tips of his eyelashes. She thought of the clang of swords on swords, the beauty of the turmoil of the battle, the sea, the sky. She wondered if that was how Mark had felt in the Wild Hunt. When there was nothing between you and the elements, it was easy to forget what weighed you down. She thought of the blood on Cortana, the blood ribboning out from under Fowl's body, mixing with the rainwater. They'd rolled his corpse under an overhang of stones, not wanting to leave him there, exposed to the weather, even though he was long past caring.
I killed one of the riders, she said now in a near whisper.
You had to. Julian's hand was strong on her shoulder, fingers digging in. Emma, it was a fight to the death.
The Clave will understand. The fair folk won't. The Unseelie King won't.
The faintest ghost of a smile passed over Julian's face. I don't think he likes us anyway. Emma took a tense breath.
Fal had you backed up against the edge of the cliff, she said. I thought he was going to kill you.
Julian's smile faded. I'm sorry, he said. I'd hidden the crossbow there earlier.
I didn't know, Emma said.
It's my job to sense what's going on with you in battle, to understand it, to anticipate you.
But I didn't know.
She threw the bath towel. It landed on the kitchen floor. The mug Julian had broken earlier was gone. He must have cleaned it up. Despair bubbled up inside her. Nothing she'd done had worked. They were in exactly the same place they'd been before, only Julian didn't know it. That was all that had changed.
I tried so hard, she whispered.
His face crinkled in confusion.
In the battle?
Emma, you did everything you could.
Not in the battle. To make you not love me, she said. I tried.
She felt him recoil, not so much outwardly as inwardly, as if his soul had flinched.
Is it that awful, having me love you?
She had started trembling again, though not from the cold.
It was the best thing in the world, she said. And then it was the worst. And I didn't even have a chance.
She broke off. He was shaking his head, scattering water droplets.
You're going to have to learn to live with it, he said. Even if it horrifies you. Even if it makes you sick.
Just like I'm going to have to live with whatever other boyfriends you have. Because we are forever, no matter how, Emma, no matter what you want to call what we have. We will always be us.
There won't be any other boyfriends, she said.
He looked at her in surprise.
What you said before, about thinking and obsessing and wanting only one thing, she said. That's how I feel about you.
He looked stunned. She put her hands up to gently cup his face, brushing her fingers over his damp skin. She could feel the pulse hammering in his throat. There was a scratch on his face, a long one that went from his temple to his chin. Emma wondered if he'd just gotten it in the fight outside, or if he'd had it before and she hadn't noticed because she'd been trying so hard not to look at him. She wondered if he was ever going to speak again.
"Jules," she said, "say something, please."
His hands tightened convulsively on her shoulders. She gasped as his body moved against hers, walking her backward until her back hit the wall. His eyes gazed down into hers, shockingly bright, radiant as sea glass. "Julian," he said. "I want you to call me Julian. Only ever that."
"Julian,"
she said, and then his mouth came down over hers, dry and burning hot, and her heart seemed to stop and start again, an engine revved into an impossibly high gear. She clutched him back with the same desperation, clinging on as he drank the rain from her mouth, her lips parting to taste him, clothes and tea. She reached to yank his sweater off over his head. Under it was a t-shirt, a thin, wet cloth, not much of a barrier when he pressed her back against the wall. His jeans were wet too, molded to his body. She felt how much he wanted her, and wanted him just as much. The world was gone, and there was only Julian, the heat of his skin, the need to be closer to him, to fit herself against him. Every movement of his body against hers sent lightning through her nerves.
"Emma. God, Emma."
He buried his face against her, kissing her cheek, her throat, as he slid his thumbs under the waistband of her jeans and pushed down. She kicked the wet heap of denim away.
"I love you so much."
It felt as if it had been 1,000 years since that night on the beach. Her hands rediscovered his body, the hard planes of it, his scars rough under her palms. He'd once been so skinny. She could still see him as he had been even 2 years ago, awkward and gangly. She'd loved him then, even if she hadn't known it. Loved him from the center of his bones to the surface of his skin. Now those bones were clothed and covered in smooth muscle, hard and unyielding. She ran her hands up under his shirt, relearning him, tracing him, embedding the feel and texture of him in her memory.
"Julian," she said, I love you," she was about to say. "It wasn't ever Cameron or Mark. It was always you. It will always be you. The marrow of my bones is made up of you, like cells make up our blood."
But he cut her off with a hard kiss.
"Don't," he whispered. "I don't want to hear anything reasonable. Not now. I don't want logic. I want this." "But you need to know."
He shook his head. "I don't." He reached down, grabbed the hem of his shirt, dragged it off. His wet hair showered droplets on them both.
"I've been broken for weeks," he said unsteadily. And she knew what that cost him, that admission of lack of control. "I need to be whole again, even if it doesn't last." "It can't last," she said, staring at him, because how could it, when they could never keep what they had? "It'll break our hearts."
He caught her by the wrist, brought her hand to his bare chest, splayed her fingers over his heart. It beat against her palm, like a fist punching its way through his sternum.
"Break my heart," he said. "Break it into pieces. I give you permission."
The blue of his eyes had almost disappeared behind the expanding rims of his pupils. She hadn't known before on the beach what was going to happen, what it would be like between them. Now she did. There were things in life you couldn't refuse. No one had that much willpower.
No one.
She was nodding her head without even knowing she was going to do it.
"Julian, yes," she said. "Yes."
She heard him make an almost anguished sound. Then his hands were on her hips. He was lifting her so she was pinned between his body and the wall. It felt desperate, world-ending, and she wondered if there would ever be a time when it wouldn't, when it could be soft and slow and
quietly loving. He kissed her fiercely, and she forgot gentleness or any desire for it. There was only this, his whispering her name as they pushed aside the clothes that needed to be pushed aside. He was gasping, a faint sheen of sweat on his skin, damp hair plastered to his forehead. He lifted her higher, pressed toward her so fast his body collided with hers. She heard the ragged moan dragged out of his throat. When he lifted his face, eyes black with desire, she stared at him, wide-eyed. "You all right?" he whispered. She nodded. "Don't stop." His mouth found hers, unsteady, his hands shaking where they held her. She could tell he was fighting for every second of control. She wanted to tell him it was fine, it was all right. But coherence had deserted her. She could hear the waves outside, smashing brutally against the rocks. She closed her eyes and heard him say that he loved her. And then her arms were around him, holding him as his knees gave way and they sank to the floor, clutching each other like the survivors of a ship that had run aground on some distant, legendary shore. Tavi, Rafe, and Max were easy enough to locate. They'd been in the care of Bridget, who was amusing them by letting them annoy Jessamine so that she knocked things off high shelves, thus sparking a do-not-tease-ghosts lecture from Magnus. Drew, on the other hand, was nowhere to be found. She wasn't in her bedroom any longer, or hiding in the library or the parlor, and the kids hadn't seen her. Possibly Jessamine could have helped them more, but Bridget had reported that she had flounced off after the children were done bothering her, and besides, she only liked talking to Kit. "Drew wouldn't leave the Institute, would she?" Mark said. He was stalking down the corridor, shoving doors open left and right. "Why would she do something like that?" "Mark." Kieran took the other boy by his shoulders and turned him so that they faced each other. Christina felt a throb in her wrist, as if Mark's distress were communicating itself to her through the binding. Of course, Mark and Kieran shared another kind of binding, the binding of shared experience and emotion. Kieran was holding Mark by the shoulders, concentrating on nothing but him in that way that fairies had. And Mark was relaxing slowly, some of the tension leaving his body. "Your sister is here," said Kieran, "and we will find her."
"We'll split up and look," said Alec. "Magnus?"
Magnus swung Max up into his arms and headed down the hallway, the other two kids trailing behind him. The rest of them agreed to meet back in the library in 20 minutes. Each of them got a quadrant of the Institute to search. Christina wound up with West, which took her downstairs into the ballroom. She wished it hadn't. The memories of dancing there with Mark and then with Kieran were confusing and distracting. And she didn't need to be distracted now. She needed to find Drew. She headed down the stairs and froze. There on the landing was Drusilla, all in black, her brown braids tied with black ribbon. She turned a pale, anxious face to Christina.
"I was waiting for you," she said.
"Everyone's looking for you," Christina said. "Ty and Livy."
"I know, I heard, I was listening," said Drew.
"But you weren't in the library."
"Please," Drew said. "You have to come with me. There's not a lot of time."
She turned and hurried up the stairs. After a moment, Christina followed her.
"Drew? Mark's worried. The riders are terribly dangerous. He needs to know you're all right."
"I'll go and tell him I'm fine in a second," Drew said. "But I need you to come with me."
"Drew."
They made it to the hallway where most of the spare bedrooms were.
"Look," said Drew. "I just need you to do this, okay? If you try yelling for Mark, I promise you there are places in this Institute I can hide where you won't find me for days."
Christina couldn't help being curious.
"How do you know the Institute so well?"
"You would too if every time you showed your face someone tried to make you babysit," said Drew. They'd reached her bedroom. She stood hesitating with her hand on the knob of the door.
"But we looked in your bedroom," Christina protested.
"I'm telling you," said Drew, "hiding places."
She took a deep breath.
"Okay, you go in there and don't freak out."
Drew's small face was set and determined, as if she were nerving herself to do something unpleasant.
"Is everything all right?" Christina said. "Are you sure you wouldn't rather talk to Mark than me?"
"It isn't me who wants to talk to you," Drew said,
and pushed her bedroom door open. Christina stepped inside, feeling more puzzled than ever. She only saw a shadow first, a figure in front of the windowsill. Then he stood up and her heart caught in her throat. Brown skin, tangled black hair, sharp features, long lashes. The faint slouch to the shoulders she remembered that she used to tell him always made him look as if he were walking into a high wind.
Jaime, she breathed.
He reached out his arms, and a moment later she was hugging him tightly. Jaime had always been skinny, but now he felt positively prickly with pointed collarbones and sharp elbows. He hugged her back tightly, and Christina heard the bedroom door close quietly, the lock clicking. She pulled back and looked up into Jaime's face. He looked like he always did, bright-eyed, edged with mischief. So, he said, you really missed me. All the night she'd stayed up sobbing because of him, because he was missing, because she hated him, because he'd been her best friend and she hated hating him. Burst. Her left palm cracked against his cheek, and then she was hitting him on the shoulders and the chest, wherever she could reach. Ow! He writhed away. That hurts!
Me vale madre! She hit him again.
How dare you disappear like that? Everyone was worried. I thought maybe you were dead. And now you turn up hiding in Drusilla Blackthorne's bedroom? Which, by the way, if her brothers find out, they will kill you dead.
It wasn't like that.
Jaime windmilled his arms as if to fend off her blows.
I was looking for you.
She put her hands on her hips.
After all this time avoiding me, suddenly you're looking for me?
It wasn't you I was avoiding, he said. He took a crumpled envelope out of his pocket and held it up to her. With a pang, she recognized Diego's handwriting.
If Diego wants to write to me, he doesn't need the message hand-delivered, she said. What does he think you are, a carrier pigeon?
He can't write to you, said Jaime. Zara watches all his mail.
So you know about Zara? Christina said, taking the envelope. How long?
Jaime slouched back against a large oak desk, hands propped behind him.
How long have they been engaged? Since you two broke up the first time.
But it's not a real engagement, Christina. She sat down on Drew's bed. It seemed real enough. Jaime ran a hand through his black hair. He looked only a little like Diego, maybe in the set of his mouth, the shape of his eyes. Jaime had always been playful where Diego was serious. Now, tired and skinny, he resembled the glum, style-conscious boys who hung around coffee shops in the Colonia Roma.
I know you probably hate me, he said. You've got every reason. You think I wanted our branch of the family to take over the Institute because I wanted power and didn't care about you. But the fact is, I had a good reason.
I don't believe you, Christina said.
Jaime made an impatient noise.
I'm not self-sacrificing, Tina, he said. That's Diego, not me. I wanted our family to be out of trouble.
Christina dug her hands into the bedspread.
What kind of trouble? You know we've always had a connection with the fairies, said Jaime. It's where that necklace of yours comes from. But there's always been more to it than that. Most of it didn't matter until the cold piece. Then the family was supposed to turn everything over to the Clave, all their information, anything the fairies had ever given them.
But they didn't, Christina guessed.
They didn't, said Jaime. They decided the relationship with the Adas was more important than the cold piece.
He shrugged fluidly.
There's an heirloom. It has power even I don't understand. The Dearborns and the cohort demanded it. And we told them only a Rosales could make the object work.
Realization came to Christina with a hard shock.
Saw the fake engagement, she said. So Zara could think she was becoming a Rosales.
Exactly, said Jaime.
Diego ties himself to the cohort, and I take the heirloom and run. So Diego can blame me. His bad little brother ran off with it. And the engagement drags on, and they don't find the heirloom.
Is that your only plan? Christina said. Delay forever?
Jaime frowned at her.
I don't think you entirely appreciate that I've been very bravely on the run for months now, he said. Very bravely.
We are Nephilim, Jaime. It's our job to be brave, Christina said.
Some of us are better at it than others, Jaime said. Anyway, I will not say our whole plan is to delay, no.
Diego works to find out what the cohort's weaknesses are, and I find out what the heirloom does, exactly. You don't know? He shook his head. I know it helps you enter Ferry undetected. And the cohort wants to be able to enter Ferry so they can start a war, Christina guessed. That would make sense, said Jaime. To them, anyway. Christina sat on the bed in silence. Outside it had begun to rain. Water streaked the window panes. She thought of rain on the trees in the bosque, and sitting there with Jaime, watching him eat bags of Dorilocos and lick the salt off his fingers. And talking for hours, about literally everything, about what they would do when they were Parabatai and could travel anywhere in the world. Where are you going to go? She said finally, trying to keep her voice steady. I can't tell you. He pulled himself away from the desk. I can't tell anyone. I'm a good escape artist, Christina, but only if I never tell where I'm hiding. You don't know, do you? She said. You're going to improvise. He smiled sideways. No one knows me better than you. And Diego? Christina's voice shook. Why didn't he ever tell me this? People do stupid things when they're in love, said Jaime in the voice of someone who had never been. And besides, I asked him not to. So why are you telling me now? Two things, he said. In Downworld, they say the Blackthorns are going up against the cohort. If it comes to a fight, I want to be in it. Send me a fire message. I will come. His tone was earnest. And secondly, to deliver Diego's message. He said you might be too angry to read it, but I was hoping that now you would not be. She looked down at the envelope in her hand. It had been bent and folded many times. I'll read it, she said quietly. Won't you stay? Eat a meal with us. You look starved. Jaime shook his head. No one can know I was here, Tina. Promise me. On the fact that we were once going to be Parabatai. That isn't fair, she whispered. Besides, Drusilla knows. She won't tell anyone, Jaime began. Christina! It was Mark's voice echoing down the hallway. Christina! Where are you? Jaime's arms were around her suddenly, wiry strong as he hugged her hard. When he let go, she touched his face lightly. There were a million things she wanted to say. Ten cuidado, more than anything. Be safe. Be careful. But he was already turning away from her toward the window. He threw it open and ducked outside like a shadow, vanishing into the rain-streaked night. Chapter 25 Start and Sigh. Gwyn wouldn't come into the Institute. Kid didn't know if it was principle or preference, but despite the fact that his arm was bleeding, soaking the side of his armor, the Wild Hunt leader only shook his head when Alec invited him cordially into the Institute. I am the head of the London Institute, however temporarily, Alec said. I am empowered to invite whoever I want inside. I cannot linger, Gwyn demurred. There is much to be done. It had begun to rain. Alec was on the roof along with Mark, who had greeted Livy and Ty with a mixture of terror and relief. The twins were still standing close to their brother, his arm around Livy's shoulder, his hand clasping Ty's sleeve. There was no one to greet Kit that way. He stood off a little to the side, watching. The ride on horseback from the river, Gwyn seemed to be able to summon horses out of the air like a magician conjuring pennies, had been a blur. Ty and Livy had ridden with Diana, and Kit had wound up behind Gwyn, clinging desperately to his belt and trying not to fall off the horse into the Thames. I cannot stay among all this cold iron, Gwyn said, and he did look fairly piqued, in Kit's opinion. And you, Blackthorns, you should get yourself inside the Institute. Within its walls you are safe.
What about Emma and Jules? Livy said. They could be outside. The riders could be looking for them.
Magnus went to find them, Alec reassured her. He'll make sure they're all right. Livy nodded gravely, but she still looked worried. We might need some help from you, Diana, said Alec. We're sending the children to Alicante as soon as Magnus returns.
Which children? Asked Diana.
She had a soft, low voice. Now it was rough with tiredness.
Just yours or Tavi and Drusilla as well, Alec said. He eyed Livy and Ty. Kit guessed that if he had his druthers, Alec would bring the twins along too, but he knew they'd never stand for it.
Ah, said Diana. Might I suggest that rather than taking up residence with the Inquisitor in Alicante, you stay with me on Flintlock Street? It would be good if the cohort didn't know you were there.
My thought exactly, said Alec. Better to stay under the radar of the Dearborns and their ilk, especially just before the council meeting. He frowned. And hopefully we'll be able to get the binding spell off Mark and Christina before we need to leave. Otherwise, they might not be able to...
One of the riders was killed, Kit said.
Everyone stared at him. He wasn't sure why he'd spoken himself. The world seemed to be swaying around him, and strange things were important.
You remember, he said. It's why they fled in the end. One of them had died, and the others could feel it. Maybe Julian and Emma fought with them and won.
No one can kill one of the riders of Manon, said Gwyn.
Emma could, said Livy. If Cortana...
Kit's knees gave out. It was very sudden, and he hadn't expected it at all. One moment he was standing, the next he was kneeling in a cold puddle, wondering why he couldn't get up.
Kit! Diana cried. Alec, he hit his head during the fight. He said it didn't hurt, but...
Alec was already striding over to Kit. He was stronger than he looked. His arms braced Kit, lifting him. A hot dart of pain went through Kit's head as he moved, and a merciful grayness closed in. They lay on the bed afterward in the twilight dark, Emma with her head on Julian's chest. She could hear his heart beating through the soft material of his t-shirt. They had toweled their hair and put on dry clothes and curled up together under one layer of blankets. Their feet were tangled together. Julian was running a slow, thoughtful hand through her loose hair.
Tell me, he said. You said there was something I needed to know, and I stopped you. He paused. Tell me now.
She folded her arms on his chest, resting her chin on them. There was relaxation in the curve of his body around hers, but his expression was more than curious. She could see the intensity in the back of his eyes, his need to know, to make sense out of all the pieces that didn't make sense now.
I was never dating Mark, she said. That was all a lie. I asked him to pretend to be dating me, and he had said he owed me his life before, so he agreed. It was never real.
His fingers stilled in her hair. Emma swallowed. She had to get through all this without thinking of whether Julian would hate her at the end, otherwise she'd never be able to finish.
Why would you do that? He said carefully. Why would Mark agree to hurt me?
He didn't know he was hurting you, Emma said. He never knew there was anything between us, not until we went to Ferry. He found out then, and he told me we had to end it. That's why I stopped things in London. Mark didn't mind. We didn't feel that way about each other.
So Mark didn't know, he said.
Why did you do it then?
He held up a hand. Never mind, I know the answer. To stop me loving you. To break us up. I even know why you picked Mark.
I wish it could have been anyone else.
No one else would have made me hate you, he said flatly. Nobody else would have made me give you up. He propped himself up on his elbow, looking down at her.
Make me understand, he said. You love me, and I love you, but you wanted to wreck all that. You were so determined you brought Mark into it, which I know you'd never do if you weren't desperate.
So what made you desperate, Emma? I know being in love with your parapetite is forbidden, but it's a stupid law.
It's not, she said, a stupid law.
He blinked. His hair was dry now.
Whatever you know, Emma, he said in a low voice, it's time to tell me. So she did. Leaving nothing out, she told him what Malcolm had said to her about the parapetite curse, about how he was showing her mercy, killing her, when otherwise she and Julian would watch each other die, how the Nephilim hated love, what Jem had confirmed for her, the terrible fate of Parabatai who fell in love, the death and destruction they would bring down around them, how she knew that neither of them could ever become mundanes or downworlders to break the bond,
how being shadow hunters was part of their souls and their selves, how the exile from their families would destroy them. The light from the fire threw a dark gold glow across his face, his hair, but she could see how pale he was, even under that, and the starkness that took over his expression as she spoke, as if the shadows were growing harsher. Outside, the rain poured steadily down. When she was done, he was silent for a long time. Emma's mouth was dry, as if she'd been swallowing cotton. Finally, she could stand it no longer and move toward him, knocking the pillow onto the floor.
Jules,
he held a hand up.
Why didn't you tell me any of this?
She looked at him, miserably.
Because of what Jem said. That finding out that what we had was forbidden for good reason would just make it worse.
Believe me, knowing what I know hasn't made me love you any less. His eyes were such a dark blue in the dim light they looked like Kit's. So you decided to make me hate you.
I tried, she whispered. I didn't know what else to do.
But I could never hate you, he said. Hating you would be like hating the idea of good things ever happening in the world. It would be like death. I thought you didn't love me, Emma, but I never hated you.
And I thought you didn't love me.
And it didn't make any difference, did it? We still loved each other. I understand why you were so upset about what we did to Port Hollow Church now. She nodded.
The curse makes you stronger before it makes you destructive.
I'm glad you told me. He touched her cheek, her hair. Now we know nothing we can do will change how we feel about each other. We'll have to find another solution. There were tears on Emma's face, though she didn't remember starting to cry.
I thought if you stopped loving me, you'd be sad for a while. And if I was sad forever, that'd be okay. Because you'd be all right. And I'd still be your Parabatai. And if you could be happy eventually, I could be happy too, for you.
You're an idiot, Julian said. He put his arms around her and rocked her, his lips against her hair, and he whispered, the way he whispered when Tavi had nightmares, that she was brave to have done what she did, that they'd fix it all, they'd find a way. And even though Emma could still see no way out for them, she relaxed against his chest, letting herself feel the relief of having shared the burden just for this moment. But I can't be angry. There's something I should have told you as well. She drew away from him.
What is it?
He was fiddling with his glass bracelet. Since Julian rarely expressed any anxiety in a visible way, Emma felt her heart thump.
Julian, she said, tell me.
When we were going into Faerie, he said in a low voice, the Pooka told me that if I entered the lands, I would meet someone who knew how to break the Parabatai bond. The thumping of Emma's heart became a rapid tattoo, beating against the inside of her rib cage. She sat up straight.
Are you saying you know how to break it?
He shook his head. The wording was correct. I met someone who did know how to break it. The Seelie Queen, to be precise. She told me she knew it could be done, but not how.
Is that part of returning the book? Emma said.
We give her the black volume. She tells us how to end the bond. He nodded. He was looking at the fire.
You didn't tell me, she said. Is that because you thought I wouldn't care?
Partially, he said. If you didn't want the bond broken, then neither did I. I'd rather be your Parabatai than nothing.
Jules.
Julian. And there's more, he said. She told me there would be a cost.
Of course,
a cost. There's always a cost when fairies are involved.
What kind of cost? She whispered.
Breaking the bond involves using the black volume to dig out the root of all Parabatai ceremonies, said Julian. It would break our bond, yes, but it would also destroy every Parabatai bond in the world. They'd all be snapped. There'd be no more Parabatai. Emma stared at him in absolute shock. We couldn't possibly do that. Alec and Chase, Clary and Simon, there are so many others. You think I don't know that? But I could not tell you. You have a right to know. Emma felt as if she could barely breathe. The Queen, a sharp bang echoed through the room as if someone had set off a firecracker. Magnus Bane appeared in their kitchen, wrapped in a long black coat, his right hand sparking blue fire, his expression thunderous. "Why in the names of the nine princes of hell are neither of you answering your phone?" he demanded. Emma and Julian gaped at him. After a moment, he gaped back. "My God," he said. "Are you..." He didn't finish the question. He didn't have to. Emma and Julian scrambled out of the bed. They were both mostly dressed, but Magnus was looking at them as if he'd caught them in flagrante. "Magnus," Julian said. He didn't follow up his greeting by saying it wasn't like that, or Magnus was getting the wrong idea. Julian didn't say things like that. "What's going on? Is something wrong at home?" Magnus looked at the moment like he was feeling his age. "Parabatai," he said, and sighed. "Yes, something's wrong. We need to get you back to the Institute. Grab your things and get ready to leave." He leaned back against the kitchen island, crossing his arms. He was wearing a sort of great coat with several layers of short capes in the back. He was dry. He must have portaled from the inside of the Institute. "There's blood on your sword, Emma," he said, looking at where Cortana was propped against the wall. "Fairy blood," said Emma. Julian was yanking on a sweater and running his fingers through his wild hair. "When you say fairy blood," Magnus said, "you mean the riders, don't you?" Emma saw Julian start. "They were looking for us. How would you know?" "They weren't just looking for you. The king sent them to find the Black Volume. He instructed them to hunt all of you. All the Blackthorns." "To hunt us?" Julian demanded. "Is anyone hurt?" He strode across the room to Magnus, almost as if he meant to grab the warlock by his shirt and shake him. "Is anyone in my family hurt?" "Julian," Magnus's voice was firm. "Everyone's fine. But the riders did come. They attacked Kit and Ty and Livy." "And they're all right?" Emma demanded anxiously, shoving her feet into her boots. "Yes. I got a fire message from Alec," Magnus said. "Kit got a bump on the head. Ty and Livy, not a scratch. But they were lucky. Gwyn and Diana intervened."
"Diana and Quinn, together?"
Emma was baffled.
"Emma killed one of the riders," Julian said. He was gathering up Annabelle's portfolio, Malcolm's diaries, shoving them into his bag. "We hid his body up on the cliff, but we probably shouldn't leave it there."
Magnus whistled between his teeth.
"No one's killed one of Manon's riders in, well, in all the history I know."
Emma shuddered, remembering the cold feeling as the blade had gone into Fowl's body.
"It was horrible."
"The rest of them are not gone forever," said Magnus. "They will be back."
Julian zipped his bag and Emma's.
"Then we need to take the children somewhere safe, somewhere the riders can't find them." "Right now, the Institute is the safest place outside Idris," said Magnus. "It's warded, and all warded again."
"The cottage is safe, too," Emma said, hoisting her bag over her shoulder. It was twice as heavy as it had been before, with the addition of Malcolm's books. "The riders can't come near it. They said so."
"Thoughtful of Malcolm," said Magnus. "But you'd be trapped inside the house if you stayed, and I can't imagine you'd want to be unable to leave these four walls."
"No," Julian said, but he said it quietly. Emma could see Magnus raking his gaze over the interior of the cottage. The mess of teacups they hadn't cleaned up, the signs of Julian's cooking, the disarray of bed covers, the remains of a fire in the grate. The place built by and for two people who loved each other yet weren't allowed to, and that had sheltered two more such people 200 years later.
"I suppose we wouldn't."
There was sympathy in Magnus's eyes when he looked back at Julian and at Emma, too.
"All dreams end when you wake," he said. "Now come, I'll portal us home."
Drew watched the rain streak her bedroom windows. Outside, London was a blur, the glow of streetlights expanding in the rain to become yellow dandelion clocks of light perched on elongated metal posts. She had been in the library long enough to tell Mark that she was fine before he'd gotten worried about Christina and gone looking for her. When they'd both returned, Drew's stomach had tightened with fear. She'd been sure Christina was going to tell everyone about Jaime, spill her secret, spill his. The expression on Christina's face wasn't comforting, either. "Can I talk to you in the hall, Drew?" she had said. Drew nodded and put her book down. She hadn't been reading it anyway. Mark had gone over to Kieran and the children, and Drew followed Christina out into the hall. "Thank you," Christina said as soon as the door was shut, "for helping Jaime." Drew cleared her throat. Being thanked seemed like a good sign, at least a sign that Christina wasn't mad. Maybe. Christina smiled. She had dimples. Drew immediately wished she had them, too. Did she? She'd have to check. Though smiling at herself in the mirror sounded a little bizarre. "Don't worry. I won't tell anyone he was here or that you helped him." "It must not have been easy, putting up with him as you did."
"I didn't mind," Drew said. "He listened to me."
Christina's dark eyes were sad.
"He used to listen to me once, too." "Is he going to be all right?" Drew asked.
"I think so," Christina said. "He has always been smart and careful."
She touched Drew's cheek.
"I'll let you know if I hear from him."
And that was that. Drew had gone back to her bedroom, feeling hollow. She knew she was supposed to stay in the library, but she needed to be where she could think. She sat on the edge of her bed, kicking her legs listlessly. She wanted Jaime to be there so she'd have someone to talk to. She wanted to talk about the fact that Magnus looked tired, that Mark was stressed, that she was worried about Emma and Jules. She wanted to talk about how she missed home, the smell of ocean and desert. She swung her legs harder, and her heel collided with something. Bending down, she saw with surprise that Jaime's duffel bag was still stuffed under her bed. She pulled it out from under the mattress, trying not to spill the contents. It was already unzipped. He must have shoved it there in a hurry when Christina came in. But why would he leave it? Did it mean he was planning on coming back? Or had he just left behind the stuff he didn't need? She didn't mean to look inside, or at least that was what she told herself later. It wasn't that she needed to know if he was coming back. It was just an accident. Stuffed inside were a jumble of boys' clothes, a bunch of jeans and shirts, a few books, spare steelies, unactivated serif blades, a Bali song not unlike Christina's, and some photographs. And something else, something that shone brightly that she thought for a moment was a witch light, but the illumination was far less white than that. It glowed with a dim, deep gold color, like the surface of the ocean. Before she knew it, her hand was on it. She felt herself jerked off her feet, as if she were being sucked into a portal. She yanked her hand back, but she was no longer touching anything. She was no longer in her room at all. She was underground, in a long corridor dug out of the earth. The roots of trees grew down into the space, like the curling ribbon on expensively wrapped gifts. The corridor stretched away to either side of her, into shadows that deepened like no shadows above ground. Drew's heart was pounding. A terrible sense of unreality choked her. It was as if she'd traveled through a portal, but with no idea where she'd gone, and no sense of familiarity. Even the air in the place smelled like something strange and dark, some kind of scent she'd never breathed before. Drew reached automatically for the weapons in her belt, but there was nothing there. She'd come here completely unprepared, in only jeans and a black t-shirt with cats on it. She choked back a hysterical laugh and moved to press herself against the wall of the underground corridor, keeping to the depth of the shadows. Lights appeared at the end of the hall. Drew could hear high, sweet voices in the distance. Their chatter was like the chatter of birds. Fairies. She moved blindly in the other direction and nearly fell backward when the wall gave way behind her and became a curtain of fabric. She stumbled through and found herself in a large stone room. The walls were squares of green marble, veined with thick black lines. Some of the squares were carved with golden patterns, a hawk, a throne, a
crown divided into two pieces. There were weapons in the room, ranged around on the surfaces of different tables, swords and daggers of copper and bronze, hooks and spikes and maces of all sorts of metal, except iron. There was also a boy in the room. A boy her age, maybe 13. He had turned around when she came in, and now he stared at her in astonishment.
"How dare you come into this room?"
His voice was sharp, imperious. He wore rich clothing, silk and velvet, heavy leather boots. His hair was white blonde, the color of witchlight. It was cut short, and a pale band of metal encircled it at his brow.
"I didn't mean to," Drew swallowed. "I just want to get out of here," she said. "That's all I want."
His green eyes burned.
"Who are you?"
He took a step forward, snatching a dagger up off the table beside him.
"Are you a shadow hunter?"
Drew raised her chin and stared back at him. "Who are you?" she demanded. "And why are you so rude?" To her surprise, he smiled, and there was something familiar about it. "I'm Cold Ash," he said. "Did my mother send you?" He sounded hopeful.
"Is she worried about me?"
"Drusilla," said a voice.
"Drew! Drew!"
Drew looked around in confusion. Where was the voice coming from? The walls of the room were starting to darken, to melt and merge. The boy in the rich clothes with his sharp fairy's face looked at her in confusion, raising his dagger as more holes began to open around her, in the walls, in the floor. She shrieked as the ground gave way beneath her, and she fell into darkness. The whirling air caught her again, the cold spinning almost portal, and then she slammed back to reality on the floor of her bedroom. She was alone. She gasped and choked, trying to pull herself to her knees. Her heart felt as if it were going to rip its way out of her chest. Her mind spun. The terror of being underground. The terror of not knowing if she'd ever return home. The terror of an alien place. And yet the images slipped away from her, as if she were trying to hold on to water or wind. Where was I? What happened? She raised herself to her knees, feeling sick and nauseated. She blinked away the dizziness. There were green eyes in the back of her vision. Green eyes. And saw that Jaime's duffel bag was gone. Her window was propped open, the floor damp below the window. He must have come in and out while she was gone. But where had she been? She didn't remember.
"Drew?"
The voice came again, Mark's voice, and another impatient knock on her door.
"Drew, did you hear me? Emma and Jules are back."
"There," Diana said, checking the bandage on Gwyn's arm one last time. "I wish I could give you an Arazi, but..." She let her voice trail off, feeling silly. She was the one who had insisted they go to her rooms in Alicante so she could bandage his wound, and Gwyn had been quiet ever since. He had slapped his horse's flank after they'd climbed from it into her window, sending it soaring into the sky. She'd wondered as he looked around her room, his bicolored eyes taking in all the visible traces of her life, the used coffee mugs, the pajamas thrown into a corner, the ink-stained desk, whether she'd made the right decision bringing him here. She had let so few people into her personal space for so many years, showing only what she wanted to show, controlling access to her inner self so carefully. She had never thought the first man she allowed into her room in Idris would be an odd and beautiful fairy, but she knew when he winced violently as he sat down on her bed that she'd made the right call. She'd gritted her teeth in sympathetic pain as he started to peel away his bark-like armor. Her father had always kept extra bandages in the bathroom. When she returned from her trip there, gauze in hand, she found Gwyn, shirtless and grumpy-looking on her rumpled blanket, his brown hair almost the same color as her wooden walls. His skin was several shades paler, smooth and taut over bones that were just a shade alien.
"I do not need to be ministered to," he said. "I've always bandaged my own wounds."
Diana didn't answer, just set about making a field dressing. Sitting behind him as she worked, she realized it was the closest she'd ever been to him. She thought his skin would feel like bark, like his armor, but it didn't. It felt like leather, the very softest kind that was used to make scabbards for delicate blades. "We all have wounds that are sometimes better cared for by someone else," she said, setting the box of bandages aside. "And what of your wounds?" he said. "I wasn't injured." She got to her feet, ostensibly to prove to him that she was fine, walking and breathing. Part of it was also to put some distance between them. Her heart was skipping beats in a way she didn't trust.
"You know that's not what I meant," he said. "I see how you care for those children. Why do you not just offer to head the Los Angeles Institute? You would make a better leader than Arthur Blackthorne ever did."
Diana swallowed, though her mouth was dry.
"Does it matter?"
"It matters in that I wish to know you," he said. "I would kiss you, but you draw away from me. I would know your heart, but you hide it in shadow. Is it that you do not like or want me? Because in that case I will not trouble you."
There was no intention to cause guilt in his voice, only a plain statement of fact. If he had made a more emotional plea, perhaps she would not have responded. As it was, she found herself crossing the room, picking up a book from the shelf by the bed. "If you think there's something I'm hiding, then I suppose you're right," she said. "But I doubt it's what you think." She raised her chin, thinking of her namesake, goddess and warrior, who had nothing to apologize for. "It's nothing I did wrong. I'm not ashamed. I have no reason to be. But the clave," she sighed. "Here, take this." Gwyn took the book from her, solemn-faced.
"This is a book of law," he said.
She nodded. "The laws of investiture. It details the ceremonies by which shadow hunters take on new positions, how one is sworn in as consul or inquisitor or the head of an institute." She leaned over him, opening the book to a well-examined page. "Here. When you're sworn in as the head of an institute, you must hold the mortal sword and answer the inquisitor's questions. The questions are law. They never change." Gwyn nodded.
"Which of the questions is it," he said, "that you do not want to answer?"
"Pretend that you are the inquisitor," Diana said, as if he hadn't spoken. "Ask the questions, and I will answer as if I'm holding the sword, entirely truthfully." Gwyn nodded. His eyes were dark with curiosity and something else as he began to read aloud.
"Are you a shadow hunter?"
"Yes," said Diana.
"Were you born a shadow hunter, or did you ascend?"
"I was born a shadow hunter."
"What is your family name?"
"Rayburn."
"And what was the name you were given at birth?" asked Gwyn.
"David," said Diana. "David Lawrence Rayburn." Gwyn looked puzzled.
"I do not understand."
"I am a woman," said Diana. "I always have been. I always knew I was a girl, whatever the Silent Brothers told my parents, whatever the contradiction of my body. My sister, Aria, knew too. She said she'd known it from the moment I could talk. But my parents," she broke off. "They weren't unkind, but they didn't know the options. They told me I should live as myself at home, but in public, be David. Be the boy I knew I wasn't. Stay under the radar of the clave. I knew that would be living a lie. Still, it was a secret the four of us kept. Yet with every year, my crushing despair grew. I withdrew from interaction with other shadow hunters our age. At every moment, waking and sleeping, I felt anxious and uncomfortable. And I feared I would never be happy. Then I turned 18. My sister was 19. We went to Thailand together to study at the Bangkok Institute. I met Katerina Loss there."
"Katerina Loss," said Gwyn. "She knows that you are, that you were." He frowned.
"I'm sorry. I don't know how to say it.
That you were named David by your parents."
"She knows," Diana said. "She didn't know it at the time. In Thailand, I lived as the woman I am. I dressed as myself. Aria introduced me as her sister. I was happy. For the first time, I felt free. and I chose a name for myself that embraced that freedom. My father's weapon shop had always been called Diana's Arrow, after the goddess of the hunt, who was proud and free. I named myself Diana. I am Diana. She took a ragged breath. And then my sister and I went out to explore an island where it was rumored there were Totsukon demons. It turned out not to be demons at all, but revenants, hungry ghosts, dozens of them. We fought them, but we were both injured. Katarina rescued us, rescued me. When I woke up in a small house not far away, Katarina was caring for us. I knew she'd seen my injuries, that she had seen my body. I knew she knew. Diana, said Gwyn in his deep voice, and stretched out a hand, but Diana shook her head. Don't, she said, or I won't be able to get through it. Her eyes were burning with unshed tears. I pulled the rags of my clothes around my body. I screamed for my sister, but she was dead. Had died while Katarina ministered to her. I broke down completely then. I had lost everything. My life was destroyed. That's what I thought. A tear slipped down her face. Katarina nursed me back to health and sanity. I was in that cottage with her for weeks. And she talked to me. She gave me words, which I'd never had as a gift. It was the first time I heard the word transgender. I broke into tears. I'd never realized before how much you can take from someone by not allowing them the words they need to describe themselves. How can you know there are other people like you when you've never had a name to call yourself? I know there must have been other transgender shadow hunters, that they must have existed in the past and exist now. But I have no way to search for them, and it would be dangerous to ask. A flicker of anger at the old injustice sharpened her voice. Then Katarina told me of transitioning, that I could live as myself, the way I needed to, and be acknowledged as who I am. I knew it was what I wanted. I went with Katarina to Bangkok, but not as David. I went as Diana. And I did not go as a shadow hunter. I lived with Katarina in a small apartment. I told my parents of Arya's death and that I was Diana now. They replied that they had told the council that David was the one who had died, that they loved me and understood, but that I must live in the mundane world now, for I was seeing mundane doctors, and that was against the law. It was too late for me to stop them. The Clave was told that David had died out on the island, fighting revenants. They gave David my sister's death, a death with honor. I wish they had not lied, but if they had to wear white for the boy who was gone, even if he'd never really existed, I couldn't deny them that. Katarina had worked as a nurse for years. She knew mundane medicine. She brought me to a clinic in Bangkok. I met others like myself there. I wasn't alone any longer. I was there for 3 years. I never planned to be a shadow hunter again. What I was gaining was too precious. I couldn't risk being discovered, having my secrets flayed open, being called by a man's name, having who I was denied. Through the years, Katarina guided me through the mundane medical procedure that gave me the body in whose skin I could feel comfortable. She hid my unusual test results from the doctors so they would never be puzzled by my shadow hunter blood. Mundane medicine. Gwyn echoed. It is forbidden, is it not, for a shadow hunter to seek out mundane medical treatment? Why did Katarina not simply use magic to aid you? Diana shook her head. I wouldn't have wanted that, she said. A magic spell can always be undone by another spell. I will not have the truth of myself be something that can be dissolved by a stray enchantment or passing through the wrong magical gate. My body is my body. The body I have grown into as a woman, as all women grow into their bodies. Gwyn nodded, though Diana couldn't tell if he understood. So, that is what you fear, was all he said. I'm not afraid for myself, said Diana. I'm afraid for the children. As long as I'm their tutor, I feel like I can protect them in some way. If the Clave knew what I'd done, that I'd sought out mundane doctors, I'd wind up in prison under the Silent City. Or in the Basileus, if they were being kind. And your parents. Gwyn's face was unreadable. Diana wished he would give her some kind of sign. Was he angry? Would he mock her? His calmness was making her pulse race. Did they come to you? You must have missed them.
I feared to expose them to the clave. Diana's voice hitched. Each time they spoke of a clandestine visit to Bangkok, I put them off. And then the news came that they had died, slain in a demon attack. Katerina was the one who told me. I wept all night. I could not tell my mundane friends of my parents' death because they would not understand why I didn't return home for the funeral. Then news came of the mortal war, and I realized I was still a shadow hunter. I could not let Idris suffer peril without a fight. I returned to Alicante. I told the council I was the daughter of Aaron and Lyssa Rayburn, because that was the truth. They knew there had been a brother and a sister, and the brother had died. I gave my name as Diana. In the chaos of war, no one questioned me. I rose up as Diana in battle. I fought as myself, with a sword in my hand and angel fire in my veins. And I knew I could never go back to being a mundane. Among my mundane friends, I had to conceal the existence of shadow hunters. Among the shadow hunters, I had to hide that I had once used mundane medicine. I knew either way I would have to hide part of myself. I chose to be a shadow hunter. Who else knows all this, besides Katerina? Malcolm knew. There is a medicine I must take to maintain the balance of my body's hormones. I usually get it from Katerina, but there was a time she couldn't do it and had Malcolm make it. After that, he knew. He never directly held it over my head, but I was always aware of his knowledge that he could hurt me. That he could hurt you, Gwyn murmured. His face was a mask. Diana could hear her heart beating in her ears. It was as if she'd come to Gwyn with her heart in her hands, raw and bleeding. And now she waited for him to produce the knives. All my life, I have tried to find a place to be myself. And I'm still looking for it, said Diana. Because of that, I have hidden things from people I loved. And I have hidden this from you. But I have never lied about the truth of myself. What Gwyn did next surprised Diana. He rose up from the bed, took a step forward, and went down on his knees in front of her. He did it gracefully, the way a squire might kneel to a knight, or a knight to his lady. There was something ancient in the essence of the gesture, something that went back to the heart of the core of the folk of Faerie. It is as I knew, he said. When I saw you upon the stairs of the Institute, and I saw the fire in your eyes, I knew. You were the bravest woman ever to set foot on this earth. I regret only that such a fearless soul was ever hurt by the ignorance and fear of others. Gwyn,
may I hold you? He asked. She nodded. She couldn't speak. She knelt down opposite the leader of the Wild Hunt and let him take her into his broad arms, let him stroke her hair and murmur her name in his voice that still sounded like the rumble of thunder. But now it was thunder heard from inside a warm, closed house, where everyone was safe inside.
Tavi was the first one to sense Emma and Julian's return when they portaled back into the Institute library with Magnus. He had been sitting on the floor, systematically dismantling some old toys with the assistance of Max. The moment Julian felt the floor solid under his feet, Tavi bounded upright and careened toward him, crashing into him like a train that had gone off its tracks.
"Jules!" he exclaimed, and Julian swung him up into his arms and crushed him in a hug as Tavi clung to him and babbled about what he'd seen and eaten and done in the past few days. And Jules ruffled his brother's hair and felt a tension he hadn't even known he was carrying go out of him. Christina had been sitting with Rafe, talking to him quietly in Spanish.
Mark was at the library table with Alec, and to Julian's surprise, Kieran, a mass of books open in front of them. Christina jumped to her feet and ran to hug Emma. Livy came barreling into the room, Ty following more quietly after, and Julian lowered Tavi to the ground, where he remained by Julian's side, gripping his leg, while he greeted the rest of his family in a blur of hugs and exclamations. Emma was hugging the twins, a sight that sent a dart of familiar pain through Julian's ribcage. The dread of separation, of pulling apart what belonged together, the dream of his family, Emma as his partner, the children, their responsibility. A hand touched his shoulder, jolting him out of imagination. It was Mark, who looked at him with uneasiness.
Jules?
Of course. Mark didn't realize Julian knew the truth about him and Emma. He looked worried, hopeful, like a puppy who had come begging for scraps but half expected to be slapped away from the table.
Was I that bad?
Julian wondered, guilt spearing through him. Mark hadn't even known, hadn't imagined Julian loving Emma. Had been horrified when he found out. Mark and Emma loved each other, but not romantically, which was what Julian would have wanted. His heart swelled with tenderness toward both of them, for everything they had given up to protect him, for being willing to let him hate them, if that was what it took. He drew Mark with him into a corner of the room. The hubbub of greeting went on all around them as Julian lowered his voice. I know what you did, he said. I know you were never really dating Emma. I'm grateful. I know it was for me. Mark looked surprised. It was Emma's idea, he said. Oh, believe me, I know. Julian put his hand on his brother's shoulder. And you did a good job with the kids, Magnus told me. Thank you. Mark's face lit up. It made Julian's heart ache even harder.
I mean, they got in so much trouble.
You loved them and you kept them alive, said Julian. Sometimes that's the best anyone can do. Julian pulled his brother toward him into a hard hug. Mark made a muffled noise of surprise before his own arms went around Julian, half crushing the breath out of him. Julian could feel his brother's heart hammering against his, as if the same relief and joy were beating through their shared blood. They drew apart after a moment. So, you and Emma, Mark began half hesitantly. But before Julian could reply, Livy had thrown herself at them, somehow managing to hug Julian and Mark at the same time, and the conversation vanished into laughter. Ty came more diffidently after her, smiling and touching Julian on the shoulder and then the hand as if to make sure he was really there. Tactile expression meant as much to Ty as what he could observe with his eyes. Mark was telling Emma that Drew was still in her room, but that she'd come shortly. Magnus had gone to Alec, and the two were talking quietly by the fireplace. Only Kieran remained where he was, so silent and still at the table that he could have been a decorative plant. The sight of him flicked a memory in Julian's mind, though, and he looked around for blonde hair and a sarcastic expression. Where's Kit? A flood of cross-explanations followed, the story of the riders at the riverside, the way Gwyn and Diana had saved them, Kit's injury. Emma described the four riders they'd encountered in Cornwall, though it was Julian who detailed the way Emma had killed one of them, which prompted a great deal of exclaiming.
I've never heard of anyone killing a rider before, said Christina, hurrying to the table to pick up a book. But someone must have.
No. It was Kieran, his voice even and quiet. There was something in the timbre of it that reminded Julian of the Unseelie King's voice. No one ever has. There have only ever been seven, the children of Manon, and they have lived almost since the beginning of time. There must be something very special about you, Emma Carstairs.
Emma flushed. There isn't.
Kieran was still looking at Emma, curiously. He was wearing jeans and a cream-colored sweater. He looked alarmingly human until you really examined his face and the uncanniness of his bone structure.
What was it like to kill something so old?
Emma hesitated.
It was like... Have you ever held ice so long in your hand that the coldness hurt your skin?
After a pause, Kieran nodded.
It is a deathly pain. It was like that. So we're safe here, Julian said to Magnus, partly to forestall any further questions about the dead rider, in the Institute. The riders can't reach us here. They're warded away, said Magnus. But Gwyn was able to land on the roof, Emma said. So fair folk can't be completely shut out. Gwyn is the Wild Hunt. They're different. Magnus reached down to pick up Max, who giggled and pulled at his scarf. Also, I've doubled the wards around the Institute since this afternoon. Where's Diana? Said Julian. She went back to Idris. She says she has to keep Gia and the Council happy and calm and expecting this meeting to take place with no hiccups. But we don't have the Black Volume, said Julian. Well, we still have a day and a half, said Emma, to find Annabelle. Without leaving these hallowed halls, Mark said. He sat down on the arm of one of the chairs. We are kind of trapped. I don't know if the riders realize Alec and I are here, Magnus said. Or perhaps we could prevail on Gwyn. The danger seems pretty severe, said Emma. We wouldn't feel right asking for that kind of help. Well, I'm going back to Idris with the kids. I can certainly see what I can do from there. Alec flung himself down in a chair near Rafe and ruffled the boy's dark hair. Maybe Alec could get into Blackthorn Manor, Julian thought. He was exhausted, nerves frayed from one of the best and worst days of his life. But Blackthorn Manor was probably the place on Earth Annabelle had loved the most. His mind began to tick over the possibilities. Annabelle cared about Blackthorn Manor, he said. Not Blackthorn Hall, here in London. The family didn't own that yet. The one in Idris, she loved it. So you think she might be there? Said Magnus. No, said Julian. She hates the Clave, hates Shadow Hunters. She'd be too afraid to go to Idris. I was just thinking that if it was in danger, if it was threatened, she might be called out of where she's hiding. He could tell Emma was wondering why he wasn't mentioning that he'd seen Annabelle in Cornwall. He wondered it a bit himself, but his instincts told him to keep it secret a little longer. Are you suggesting we burn down Blackthorn Manor? Said Ty, his eyebrows up around his hairline. Oddly, Magnus muttered, you wouldn't be the first people to ever have that idea.
Ty, don't get so excited, Livy said. Pyromania interests me, said Ty.
I think you have to burn down several buildings before you can consider yourself to be an actual maniac for pyro, Emma said. I think before that you're just an enthusiast.
I think setting a large fire in Idris will attract attention we don't want, said Mark.
I think we don't have a lot of choices, said Julian.
And I think we should eat, Livy said hastily, patting her stomach. I'm starving.
We can discuss what we know, especially regarding Annabelle and the Black Volume, said Ty. We can pool our information.
Magnus glanced fleetingly at Alec.
After we eat, we need to send the children to Idris. Diane is standing by on the other side to help us keep the portal open, but I don't want her to have to wait too long.
It was kind of him, Julian thought, to phrase it as if sending the children to Alicante was a favor Magnus was doing for Diana, rather than a precaution taken to protect them. Tavi skipped along with Rafe and Max to the dining room, and Julian felt a pang, realizing how much his little brother had missed having friends close to his own age, even if he hadn't known it.
Jules?
He glanced down and saw that Drew was walking beside him. Her face was pale in the corridor's witchlight.
Yeah?
He resisted the urge to pat her cheek or pull her braids. She'd stopped appreciating that when she was 10.
I don't want to go to Alicante, she said. I want to stay here with you.
Drew, she hunched her shoulders up.
You were younger than me in the Dark War, she said. I'm 13. You can send the babies where it's safe, but not me. I'm a Blackthorn, just like you.
So is Tavi.
He's 7.
Drew took in a shaky breath.
You make me feel like I'm not part of this family.
Julian stopped dead. Drew stopped with him, and they both watched as the others went into the dining room. Julian could hear Bridget scolding them all. Apparently she'd been holding dinner for them for hours, though it had never occurred to her to find them and tell them so. Drew, he said, do you really want to stay? She nodded.
I really want to.
Then that's all you have to say. You can stay with us. She threw herself into his arms.
Drew wasn't a huggy sort of person, and for a moment Julian was too surprised to move. Then he put his arms around his sister and tightened them against the flood of memories. Baby Drew, sleeping in his arms, taking her first toddling steps, laughing as Emma held her over the water at the beach, barely getting her toes wet. "You're the heart of this family, baby girl," he said in the voice that only his brothers and sisters ever heard. "I promise you, you're our heart." Bridget had somewhat haphazardly set out cold chicken, bread, cheese, vegetables, and banoffee pie. Kieran picked at the vegetables while the rest of them talked over each other to lay out what they knew. Emma sat beside Julian. Every once in a while their shoulders would bump or their hands collide as they reached for something. Each touch sent a shower of sparks through him, like a small explosion of fireworks. Ty, his elbows on the table, took point on the discussion, explaining how he, Kit, and Livy had found the Aletheia crystal and the memories trapped within it. 200 years ago, Malcolm and Annabelle broke into the Cornwall Institute, he explained, his graceful hands slicing through the air as he talked. Something seemed different about Ty, Julian thought, though how could his brother have changed in the few short days he'd been away? They stole the Black Volume, but they were caught. "Do we know why they wanted it?" Christina asked. "I do not see how necromancy could have helped them." "They plan to trade it to someone else, it looks like," said Emma. "The book wasn't for them. Someone had promised to trade them protection from the clave for it." It was a time when a relationship between a shadow hunter and a downworlder could have meant a death sentence for both of them, said Magnus. Protection would have been a very attractive offer. "They never got that far," Ty said. "They were both caught and thrown in prison in the Silent City, and the Black Volume was taken from them and returned to the Cornwall Institute. Then something weird happened." He frowned. Ty didn't like not knowing things. "Malcolm disappeared. He left Annabelle to be questioned and tortured." "He wouldn't have done that willingly," said Julian. "He loved her." "People can betray even those they love," said Mark. "No, Julian's right," said Emma. "I hate Malcolm more than anyone. But he absolutely would never have left Annabelle. She was his whole life." "It's still what happened," said Ty. "They tortured Annabelle for information until she pretty much lost her mind," said Livy. "Then they released her to her family. And they killed her and told everyone she'd become an Iron Sister. But it wasn't true." There was a tightness in Julian's throat. He thought of Annabelle's drawings, the lightness in them, the hope, the love for Blackthorn Manor and Idris, and for Malcolm. "Fast forward almost 100 years, said Emma. "Malcolm goes to the Unseelie King. He's found that Annabelle wasn't an Iron Sister, that she was murdered. He's out for bloody vengeance." She paused, combing her fingers back through her hair, still tangled from Cornish wind and rain. "The Unseelie King tells him how to raise Annabelle, but there's a catch. Malcolm needs the Black Volume to do it, and now he doesn't have it. It's in the Cornwall Institute. He broke in there once, but he doesn't dare do it again. So there it stays until the Blackthorns who run the Institute move to Los Angeles, and they take it with them." Ty's eyes lit up. "Right. And Malcolm sees his chance when Sebastian Morgenstern attacks and takes the book. He starts to raise Annabelle, and finally he succeeds." "Except she's pissed off and kills him," said Emma. "How ungrateful," said Kieran. "Ungrateful," Emma said. "He was a murderer. She was right to kill him."
"He may have been a murderer," said Kieran, "but sounds like it became one for her. He killed to give her life."
"Maybe she didn't want life," said Alec. He shrugged. "He never did ask her what she wanted, did he?" As if sensing the tense atmosphere at the table, Max began to wail. With a sigh, Alec picked him up and carried him out of the room.
"I'm sure it's useful to know all this," said Magnus. "But does it bring us closer to the Black Volume?"
"Maybe if we had more time, and the Riders weren't after us," said Julian.
"I think," said Kieran slowly, his gaze unfocused, "that it was my father." Apparently it was his day for startling pronouncements. Everyone stared at him again. To Julian's surprise, it was Christina who spoke. "What do you mean, it was your father?"
I think he was the one who wanted the book all those years ago, when Malcolm first stole it, said Kieran. He's the thread that ties all this together. He wanted the book then, and he wants it now. But why do you think he wanted it then? Julian said. He kept his voice low and gentle, what Emma thought of as his leading the witness voice. Because of something Adain said. Kieran was looking down at his hands. He said my father had wanted the book since the first heir was stolen. 'Tis an old story in Faerie, the theft of my father's first child. It happened more than 200 years ago. Christina looked stunned. I didn't realize that's what he meant. The first heir. Magnus's eyes looked unfocused. I have heard that tale, or heard of it. The child was not just stolen, but murdered. So the story goes, said Kieran. Perhaps my father wished to use necromancy to raise the child. I could not speak of his motives. But he could have offered Fade and Annabelle protection in the Unseelie Lands. No shadow hunter could touch them if they were safe and fairy. Emma set down her fork with a clang.
Pretentious hair prince is right, Kieran blinked. What do you call me?
I'm trying it out, Emma said with a wave. And I said you were right. Enjoy it, because I doubt I'll say it again. Magnus nodded. The king is one of the few beings on this earth who could have kidnapped Malcolm from the prisons of Silent City. He must not have wanted him to reveal their connection to the council.
But why didn't he take Annabelle too? Livy asked, a forkful of pie halfway to her mouth.
Because maybe Malcolm had disappointed him by getting caught, said Mark. Maybe he wanted to punish them both.
But Annabelle could have told on them, said Livy. She could have said Malcolm was working for the king.
Not if she didn't know, said Emma. There was nothing in the diaries Malcolm kept that mentioned who he was stealing the book for, and I bet he didn't tell Annabelle either.
They tortured her, said Ty, and she still didn't say who it was, just that she had no idea. It must have been the truth.
That explains why when he found out Annabelle wasn't an Iron Sister that he'd been lied to, Malcolm went to see the Unseelie King, said Julian, because he knew him.
So, once the king wanted the book from necromancy, said Christina. Now he wants it so he can destroy Shadowhunters.
Not all necromancy is raising the dead.
Magnus was gazing at the glass of wine by his plate, as if there was some kind of secret hidden in its depth.
One moment, he said, and scooped up Rafe from the chair beside him. He turned to Tavi. Would you like to come with us and play with Alexander and Max?
After a glance at Julian, Tavi nodded. The group of them left the room, Magnus gesturing he would be right back.
This was just one meeting, said Emma. First, we need to get the council to believe that the Unseelie Court is an immediate threat. Right now, they can't tell good fairies from bad and aren't interested in trying.
Which is where Kieran's testimony comes in, said Mark. And there is some evidence. There's the blight, Diana said she saw in Brusselin Forest, and the report from the Shadow Hunters who said they fought a band of fairies, but their weapons malfunctioned.
It's not a lot to go on, said Livy, especially considering Zara and her nasty little band of bigots. They are going to try to seize power at this meeting. They're going to try to grab the Institute. They couldn't care less about some vague fairy threat.
I can make the Clave fear my father, said Kieran, but it may take all of us to make them understand that if they do not wish for a new era of darkness, they must abandon their dreams of extending the cold peace.
No registering warlocks, said Ty. No putting werewolves into camps.
The downworlders who have seats on the council all know about the cohort, said Magnus, returning without the children.
If it actually comes down to a vote about who heads the Los Angeles Institute, they'll have to bring in Maya and Lily as well as me. We're entitled to vote.
He threw himself down in a chair at the head of the table.
That's still just 3 votes, even if you vote against the cohort, said Julian.
It's a tricky business, Magnus agreed. According to Diana, Gia doesn't want Zara heading up the Los Angeles Institute any more than we do. She'll be hard to discredit at the moment. With her lie about killing Malcolm, she's pretty popular right now.
Emma made a growling noise, low in her throat. Christina patted her hand.
Meanwhile, what we have is the promise that the Queen will fight with us against a threat the Council is unlikely to believe in.
and even then only if she gets a book we don't currently have, and wouldn't be allowed to give her if we did, Magnus said. Our bargain with the Sealy Queen is our business, said Julian. Right now we say she's shown herself willing to cooperate under the right circumstances. Kieran's empowered to promise she'll help. He doesn't need to go into details.
Brother, you think like a fairy, said Mark, in a tone that made Julian wonder if that was a good thing or not.
Maybe the king wants to raise an army of the dead, said Drew, hopefully. I mean, it is a book of necromancy.
Magnus sighed, tapping a fingernail against his glass thoughtfully.
Necromancy is about doing magic that uses the energy of death to power it. All magic needs fuel. Death energy is incredibly powerful fuel. It's also incredibly destructive. The destruction of the land that you saw in Faerie, the blight in Brosselin, they are the scars left by terrible magic. The question remains, what is his ultimate goal?
You mean he needs more energy to spread those spells, said Julian. The ones that Malcolm helped with, that cancel out Shadowhunter magic.
I mean your magic is angelic in its nature, said Magnus. It comes from light, from energy and life. The opposite of that is Sheol, hell, whatever you want to call it. The absence of light in life, of any kind of hope. He coughed.
When the council voted for the cold peace, they were voting for a time that never existed. Just as the cohort wishes everything to return to a lost golden age, when Shadowhunters walked the world like gods and downworlders and mundanes bowed before them.
Everyone stared at him. This was a Magnus Bane people rarely saw, Julian thought. A Magnus whose good cheer and casual optimism had deserted him. A Magnus who was remembering the darkness of all he had seen over the centuries, the death and the loss. The same Magnus Julian had seen in the Hall of Accords when he was 12, begging the council in vain not to pass the cold peace, knowing that they would.
The king wants the same, to unite two kingdoms that have always been separate, but in his mind were one land once.
We must stop the king, but in a way he's only doing what the cohort would do. What we have to hope the Clave would not do.
You mean, said Julian, this is vengeance?
Magnus shrugged.
It is the whirlwind, he said. Let us hope we can stop it.
Chapter 26 Walk in Shadow.
Emma sat on Christina's bed, brushing her friend's hair. She was beginning to understand why her mother had loved brushing her hair so much when she was a little girl. There was something oddly soothing about the smooth, dark locks slipping through her fingers, the repetitive motion of the brush. It soothed the ache in her head, her chest, the one that felt like not just her own pain, but Julian's. She knew how much he hated saying goodbye to Tavi, even if it was for Tavi's own good, and she felt a hollowness inside herself, where Julian was parting from his smallest brother now. Being with Christina helped. Emma had spilled everything that happened in Cornwall while clucking over Christina's wrist and rubbing a mundane cream called Savlon into the red mark from the binding room. Christina ouched and complained that it stung and handed Emma a hairbrush and told her to do something actually useful.
So does anything help the binding? Said Emma. Like if Mark came in here and lay down directly on top of you, would the pain go away?
Yes, said Christina, sounding a bit muffled.
Well, it's very inconsiderate of him not to, if you ask me. Christina gave out a little wail that sounded like,
Kieran!
Right, Mark has to pretend he still cares about Kieran. I guess lying on top of you wouldn't do much for that.
He does still care about Kieran, Christina said. He's just... I think he cares about me, too.
She half turned to look at Emma. Her eyes were big and dark and worried.
I danced with him, with Mark, and we kissed. That's good.
That is good, right?
It was. But then Kieran came in.
What?
But he wasn't angry. He just told Mark that he should dance better, and he danced with me. It was like dancing with fire.
Whoa, sexy weirdness, said Emma. This may be more sexy weirdness than I can handle.
It's not weird.
It is, said Emma. You're headed for a fairy threesome or some kind of war.
Emma!
Hot fairy threesome, said Emma cheerfully. I can say I knew you when. Christina groaned.
Fine. What about you and Julian? Do you have a plan after what happened in Cornwall?
Emma sighed and put the hairbrush down. It was a lovely old silver-backed Victorian object. She wondered if it had been in the room when Christina got here, or if she'd found it somewhere else in the Institute. Already Christina's London room bore signs of her personality. Pictures had been cleaned and straightened. She'd found a colorful coverlet for her bed somewhere, and her Bali song hung on a new hook by the fireplace. Emma began to braid Christina's hair, plaiting the thick strands between her fingers.
We don't have a plan, she said. It's always the same thing. We're together, and we feel like we're invincible. Then we start to realize it's still all the same choices, and they're all bad ones.
Christina looked troubled.
It is always the same choices, isn't it? Separation from each other, or ceasing to be shadow hunters?
Emma had finished the braid. She leaned her chin on Christina's shoulder, thinking about what Julian had learned from the Seely Queen. The terrifying possibility of ending all Parabatai bonds. But it was too horrible a thing to even voice out loud.
I used to think it would help, physical distance from Julian, she said. But now I don't think it would. Nothing else has. I think no matter where I went or for how long, I would always feel like this. Some loves are very strong, like cords. They bind you, said Christina. The Bible says love is as strong as death. I believe that.
Emma scooted around to peer closer into her friend's face. Christina, she said, there's something else going on, isn't there? Something about Diego or Jaime? Christina looked down.
I can't say.
Let me help you, Emma said. You're always so strong for everyone else. Let me be strong for you. There was a knock on the door. They both looked up in surprise.
Mark, Emma thought.
There was something about the look in Christina's face. It must be Mark. But it was Kieran. Emma froze in surprise. Though she'd grown somewhat used to Kieran being around, he still made the fine hairs on Emma's arms rise with tension. It wasn't that she blamed him, specifically, for the injury she'd suffered at Irloth's hands. But the sight of him still brought it back to her. All of it. The hot sun, the sound of the whip, a copper scent of blood. It was true that he looked enormously different now. His black hair was a little wilder, more untidy, but otherwise he cut an incongruously human figure in his jeans. The wild hair hid the tops of his pointed ears, though his black and silver eyes were still startling. He gave a small, courtly bow.
My ladies.
Christina looked puzzled. Clearly she hadn't expected this visit either.
I came to speak with Christina, if she will permit it, Kieran added.
Go ahead then, Emma said. Speak.
I think he wishes to speak to me alone, said Christina in a whisper.
Yes, said Kieran. That is my request.
Christina looked at Emma.
I'll see you in the morning, then?
Huh, Emma thought. She'd missed Christina, and now a brash fairy princeling was kicking her out of her friend's room. Kieran barely spared her a glance as she climbed off the bed and headed to the door. As she passed Kieran on her way out, Emma paused, her shoulder almost touching his.
If you do anything to hurt or upset her,
she said in a voice low enough that she doubted Christina could hear it,
I will pull off your ears and turn them into lock picks, get it?
Kieran glanced at her with his night sky eyes, unreadable as clouds.
No, he said.
Let me spell it out, Emma said sharply. I love her. Don't mess around with her.
Kieran put his long, delicate hands in his pockets. He looked absolutely unnatural in his modern clothes. It was like seeing Alexander the Great in a biker jacket and leather pants. She is easy to love. Emma looked at him in surprise. It hadn't been what she'd expected him to say at all.
Easy to love.
Neen had behaved as if the concept was bizarre. But then, what did the fair folk know about love, anyway?
Would you like to sit down?
Christina inquired.
Then she wondered if she was turning into her mother, who had always claimed that the first thing one did with a guest was to offer them a seat.
"Even if they were a murderer?" Christina had asked.
"Yes, even murderers," her mother had insisted. "If you didn't offer a murderer a seat, you shouldn't have invited him in the first place."
"No," said Kieran. He moved across the room, hands in his pockets, his body language restless. Not unlike Mark's, Christina thought. They both moved as if they had energy trapped beneath their skin. She wondered what it would be like to contain so much movement and yet be forced to stay still.
"Milady," he said, "because of what I swore to you in the Seely Court, there is a bond between us. I think you have felt its force."
Christina nodded. It wasn't the enchanted bond she had with Mark, but it was there anyway, a shimmering energy when they danced, when they spoke.
"I think that force can help us do something together I cannot do alone."
Kieran came closer to the bed, drawing his hand out of his pocket. Something glimmered in his palm. He held it out to Christina, and she saw the acorn there that Mark had used earlier to summon Gwyn. It looked slightly dented, but it was whole, as if it had been sealed back together after breaking open.
"You want to summon Gwyn again?"
Christina shook her head. Her hair fell completely out of its unfastened braid, spilling down her back. She saw Kieran glance at it.
"No, he won't interfere again. You want to speak to someone else in Faerie, your brother?"
"As a thought," he inclined his head slightly. "You guess my intentions exactly."
"And you can do it? The acorn won't just call Gwyn?"
"The magic is a fairly simple one. Remember, you are not of the blood that can cast spells, but I am. It should bring a projection of my brother to us. I will ask him of our father's plans. I shall ask him as well if he can stop the riders."
Christina was astonished. "Can anyone stop the riders?"
"They are servants of the court, and under its command."
"Why are you telling me this?" Christina asked.
"Because, to summon my brother, I must reach out with my mind into Faerie," said Kieran. "And it would be safer, should I wish to keep my mind intact, for me to have a connection here in the world. Something, someone, to keep me anchored while I seek my brother."
Christina slid off the bed. Standing straight, she was only a little shorter than Kieran. Her eyes were level with his mouth.
"Why me? Why not Mark?"
"I have asked enough of Mark," he said.
"Perhaps," she said. "But even if that is true, I do not think it is the whole truth."
"Few of us are lucky enough to ever know the whole truth of anything."
She knew Kieran was young, but there was something ancient in his eyes when he spoke.
"Will you put your hand in mine?"
She gave him the hand whose wrist bore the red mark of her bond with Mark. It seemed fitting somehow. His fingers closed around hers, cool and dry, light as the touch of a leaf. With his other hand, Kieran dashed the golden acorn against the wall beside the fireplace mantel. For a moment, there was silence. Christina could hear his ragged breathing. It seemed strange for a fairy. Everything they did was at such a remove from ordinary human emotion. It was odd to hear Kieran gasp. But then she remembered his arms around her, the uneven thud of his heart. They were flesh and blood, after all, weren't they? Bone and muscle, just as shadow hunters were. And the flame of angelic blood burned in them, too. Darkness spread across the wall like a stain. Christina sucked in her breath, and Kieran's hand tightened on hers. The darkness moved and shivered and trembled and reformed. Light danced within it, and Christina could see the multicolored night sky of Faerie. And within the shadow, a darker shadow. A man, wrapped in a dark cloak. As the darkness lightened, Christina saw his grin before she saw anything else, and her heart seemed to stop. It was a grin of bones set within a skeletal half-face, beautiful on one side, deathly on the other. The cloak that wrapped him was ink-black and bore the insignia of a broken crown. He stood straight and broad, grinning his lopsided grin down at Kieran. They had not summoned Adain at all. It was the Unseelie King.
No! No!
Tabby wept, his face buried in Julian's shoulder. He'd taken the news that he was going to Idris with Alec, Max, and Rafe worse than Mark had expected. Did all children cry like this? Like everything in the world was ruined and their hearts were broken, even at the news of a short parting? Not that Mark blamed Tabby, of course. It was only that he felt as if his own heart was being shredded into pieces inside his chest as he watched Julian walk up and down the room, holding his small brother in his arms, as Tavi sobbed and pounded his back.
"Tavs," Julian said in his gentle voice, the voice Mark could hardly reconcile with the boy who had faced down the unseelie king in his own court with a knife to a prince's throat. "It's only going to be a day, 2 days at most. You get to see the canals at Alicante, the guard."
"You keep leaving," Tavi choked against his brother's shirt front. "You can't leave again."
Julian sighed. He dipped his chin, rubbing his cheek against his brother's unruly curls. Over Tavi's head, his eyes met Mark's. There was no blame in them, no self-pity, only a terrible sadness. Yet Mark felt as if guilt were crushing his ribcage. "If only were wasted words," Kieran had once said, when Mark had speculated on whether the two of them would ever have met if they had never joined the hunt. But he couldn't stop the flood of if-onlys now. If only he had been able to stay with his family. If only Julian hadn't needed to be mother and father and brother to all the younger ones. If only Tavi hadn't grown up in the shadow of death and loss. Perhaps then, every parting would not feel like the last one. "It's not your fault," said Magnus, who had appeared noiselessly at Mark's side. "You can't help the past. We grow up with losses, all of us, except the supremely lucky."
"I cannot help wishing my brother had been one of the supremely lucky," said Mark. "You can understand."
Magnus glanced toward Jules and Tavi. The little boy cried himself out and was clinging to his older brother, his face mashed against Julian's shoulder. His small shoulders were slumped in exhaustion. "Which brother?"
"Both of them," said Mark.
Magnus reached out and, with curious fingers, touched the glimmering arrowhead slung around Mark's neck.
"I know this material," he said. "This arrowhead once tipped the weapon of a soldier in the king's guard of the Unseelie Court."
Mark touched it, cool, cold, smooth under his fingers, unyielding like Kieran himself.
"Kieran gave it to me."
"It is precious," said Magnus. He turned as Alec called him and let the pendant fall back against Mark's chest. Alec stood with Max in his arms and Rafe by his side, along with a small duffel bag of their things. It occurred to Mark that Alec was close to the same age Mark would have been if only he had never been kidnapped by the hunt. He wondered if he would be as mature as Alec seemed, as self-confident, as able to take care of other people as well as himself. Magnus kissed Alec and ruffled his hair with infinite tenderness. He bent to kiss Max, too, and Rafe, and straightened up to begin to create the portal. Light sparked from and between his fingers, and the air before him seemed to shimmer. Tavi had sagged into a bundle of hopelessness against Julian's chest. Jules held him closer, the muscles in his arms tensing, and murmured soothing words. Mark wanted to go over to them, but couldn't seem to make his feet move. They seemed, even in their unhappiness, a perfect unit who needed no one else. The melancholy thought vanished a moment later as pain shot up Mark's arm. He grabbed at his wrist, his fingers encountering agonizing soreness, the slickness of blood. "Something's wrong," he thought, and then, "Christina." He bolted. The portal was growing and shimmering in the center of the room. Through its half-formed door, Mark could see the outline of the demon towers as he darted by and into the corridor. Some sense in his blood told him he was getting closer to Christina as he ran, but to his surprise, the pain in his wrist didn't fade. It pulsed again and again, like the warning beam from a lighthouse. Her door was closed. He set a shoulder against it and shoved without bothering to try the knob. It flew open, and Mark half fell inside. He choked, eyes stinging. The room smelled as if something inside had been burning,
something organic, like dead leaves or rotted fruit. It was dark. His eyes adjusted quickly, and he made out Christina and Kieran, both standing by the foot of the bed. Christina was clutching her balisong. A massive shadow loomed over them. No, not a shadow, Mark realized, moving closer. A projection. A projection of the king of the Unseelie court. Both sides of his face seemed to gleam with unnatural humor, both the beautiful, kingly side and the hideous, defleshed skull.
"You thought to summon your brother," the king sneered, his gaze on Kieran. "And you thought I would not feel you reaching into Faerie, searching for one of my own. You were a fool, Kieran, and always have been."
"And what have you done to Adain?" Kieran's face was bloodless. "He knew nothing. He had no idea I planned to summon him."
"Worry not about the others," said the king. "Worry about your own life, Kieran Kingson."
"I have been Kieran Hunter for a long time," said Kieran. The king's face darkened.
"You should be Kieran Traitor," he said. "Kieran Betrayer, Kieran Kinslayer. All are better names for you."
"He acted in self-defense," said Christina sharply. "If he hadn't killed Irek, he would have been killed himself. And he acted to protect me." The king gave her a brief look of scorn.
"And that in itself is a traitorous act, foolish girl," he said. "Placing the lives of shadow hunters above the lives of your own people, what could be worse?"
"Selling your son to the Wild Hunt? Because you were worried that people liked him better than they liked you," said Mark. "That's worse." Christina and Kieran looked at him in astonishment. It was clear they hadn't heard him come in. The king, though, evinced no surprise.
"Mark Blackthorn," he said. "Even in his choice of lovers, my son gravitates to the enemies of his people. What does that say about him?"
"That he knows better than you who his people are," Mark said. Very deliberately, he turned his back on the king. It would have been a hanging offense in the court.
"We must get rid of him," he said in a low voice to Kieran and Christina.
"Should I get Magnus?"
"He's only a projection," Kieran said. His face was drawn. "He cannot hurt us, nor can he remain forever. It's an effort for him, I think."
"Do not turn your back on me," the king roared. "Do you think I do not know your plans, Kieran? Do you think I do not know you plan to stand up and betray me before the Council of Nephilim?"
Kieran turned his face away, as if he couldn't bear to look at his father. "Then cease to do what I know you're doing," he said in a shaking voice. "Parley with the Nephilim. Do not make war on them."
"There is no parley with those who can lie," snarled the king, "and have done, and will do again. They will lie and spill the blood of our people. And once they are done with you, do you think they will let you live, treat you like one of them?"
"They have treated me better than my own father has," Kieran raised his chin.
"Have they?" The king's eyes were dark and empty. "I took some memories from you, Kieran, when you came to my court. Shall I give them back?"
Kieran looked confused.
"What use could you possibly have for my memories?"
"Some of us would know our enemies," said the king.
"Kieran," Mark said. The look in the king's eyes made fear roil in the pit of his stomach. "Do not listen. He seeks to hurt you."
"And what do you seek?" the king demanded, turning toward Mark.
Only the fact that Mark could see through him, could see the outline of Christina's bed, her wardrobe, through the transparent frame of his body, kept him from darting toward the fireplace poker and swinging it at the king. If only the king had been any sort of father. If only he hadn't thrown his son to the hunt like a bone to a pack of hungry wolves. If only he hadn't sat complacently by while Irek tortured Kieran. How different would Kieran be? How much less afraid of losing love? How much less determined to hold on to it at all costs, even if it meant trapping Mark in the hunt with him? The king's lip curled as if he could read Mark's thoughts.
"When I looked into my son's memories," he said, "I saw you, Blackthorn, Lady Nerissa's son."
His smile was malignant.
"Your mother,
died of sorrow when your father left her. My son's thoughts were half of you, of the loss of you. Mark, Mark, Mark. I wonder what it is in your bloodline that has the power to enchant our people and make fools of them. A small line had appeared between Kieran's brows. The loss of you. Kieran didn't remember losing Mark. The cold fear in Mark's stomach had spread to his veins.
Those who cannot love do not understand it, said Christina. She turned toward Kieran. We will protect you, she said. We won't let him harm you for testifying at the council.
Lies, said the king. Well-intentioned, perhaps, but still lies. If you testify, Kieran, there will be no place on this earth, or in Faerie, where you will be safe from me and my warriors. I will hunt you forever, and when I find you, you will wish you had died for what you did to Eorloth, to Erech. There is no torment you can imagine that I will not visit on you.
Kieran swallowed hard, but his voice was steady. Pain is just pain.
Oh, said his father, there is all manner of pain, little dark one.
He did not move or make any gesture the way warlocks did when they cast spells, but Mark felt an increase in the weight of the atmosphere in the room, as if the air pressure had risen. Kieran gasped and reeled back as if he'd been shot. He hit the bed, grasping at the footboard to keep himself from sliding to the floor. His hair fell over his eyes, changing from blue to black to white.
Mark. He raised his face slowly. I remember. I remember.
Kieran, Mark whispered.
I told Gwyn you had betrayed a Lord Faerie, said Kieran. I thought he would only bring you back to the hunt.
Instead they punished my family, said Mark. He knew Kieran hadn't meant it to happen, hadn't anticipated it, but the words still hurt to say.
That's why you weren't wearing your elf bolt.
Kieran's eyes fixed on the point below Mark's chin.
You did not want me. You turned me away. You hated me. You must hate me now.
I didn't hate you, Mark said. Kier.
Listen to him, murmured the king. Listen to him lie.
Then why? Kieran said. He backed away from Mark, just a step. Why did you lie to me?
Consider it, child, said the king. He looked as if he were enjoying himself. What do they want from you?
Kieran breathed in hard.
Testimony, he said. Witnessing in front of the council. You planned this, Mark? This deception?
Does everyone in the Institute know?
Yes, they must. They must.
His hair had gone black as oil.
And the queen knows too, I suppose. She planned to make a fool of me, with you.
The agony on his face was too much. Mark couldn't look at it, at Kieran. It was Christina who spoke for him.
Kieran, no, she said. It wasn't like that. And you knew?
Kieran turned a look on her that was hardly less betrayed than the one he'd turned on Mark.
You knew as well?
The king laughed. Rage went through Mark then, a blinding fury, and he seized up the poker from the fireplace. The king continued laughing as he stalked toward him, raised the poker, and swung it. It slammed against the golden acorn where it lay on the hearth before the fireplace, shattering it into powder. The king's laughter cut off abruptly. He turned a look of pure hatred on Mark and vanished.
Why did you do that? Kieran demanded. Were you afraid of what else he would tell me?
Mark threw the poker against the grate with a loud clang. He gave you your memories back, didn't he? He said.
Then you know everything.
Not everything, said Kieran, and his voice cracked and broke. Mark thought of him hanging in the thorn manacles at the Unseelie Court, and how the same despair showed in his eyes now.
I don't know how you planned this. When you decided you would lie to me and get me to do what you wanted, I don't know how much of it sickened you every time you had to touch me to pretend to want me. I don't know when you planned to tell me the truth. After I testified? Did you plan to mock me and laugh at me before the council
or wait until we were alone? Did you tell everyone what a monster I am, how selfish and how heartless?
You are not a monster, Kieran, Mark interrupted. There's nothing wrong with your heart.
There was only hurt in Kieran's eyes as he regarded Mark across the small space that separated them.
That cannot be true, he said. For you were my heart.
Stop!
It was Christina, her voice small and worried but firm.
Let Mark explain to you. I am done with human explanations, said Kieran, and stalked from the room, slamming the door behind him.
The last of the shimmering portal disappeared. Julian and Magnus stood, almost shoulder to shoulder, watching Alec and the children until they vanished. With a sigh, Magnus tossed the end of his scarf over his shoulder and stalked across the room to fill a glass from the decanter of wine that rested dustily on a table by the window. It was nearly dark outside, the sky over London the color of pansy petals.
"Do you want some?"
he asked Julian, recapping the decanter.
"I should probably stay sober."
"Suit yourself." Magnus picked up his wine glass and examined it. The light shining through it turned the liquid ruby red.
"Why are you helping us so much?" Julian asked. "I mean, I know we're a likable family, but no one's that likable."
"No," Magnus agreed with a slight smile. "No one is."
"Then?"
Magnus took a sip of wine and shrugged. "Jace and Clary asked me to," he said. "And Jace is Alec's parabatai. And I've always had a fatherly feeling toward Clary. They're my friends, and there is little I wouldn't do for my friends."
"Is that really all of it?"
"You might remind me of someone."
"Me?" Julian was surprised. People rarely said that to him. "Who do I remind you of?"
Magnus shook his head without answering.
"Years ago," he said, "I had a recurring dream about a city drowned in blood. Towers made of bones and blood running in the streets like water. I thought later that it was about the Dark War. And indeed, the dream vanished in the years after the war was fought." He drained his glass and set it down. "But lately, I've been dreaming it again. I can't help but think something is coming."
"You warned them," said Julian. "The Council. The day they decided to exile Helen and abandon Mark. The day they decided on the Cold Peace. You told them what the consequences would be." He leaned against the wall.
"I was only 12, but I remember it.
You said, the fair folk have long hated the Nephilim for their harshness. Show them something other than harshness, and you will receive something other than hate in return. But they didn't listen to you, did they?"
"They wanted their revenge, the Council," said Magnus.
"They didn't see how revenge begets more revenge.
For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind."
"From the Bible," said Julian. He had not grown up around Uncle Arthur without learning more classic quotes than he'd ever know what to do with. "But then there's a difference between revenge and vengeance," he added, "between punishing the guilty and punishing at random. Justly we rid the earth of human fiends who carry hell for pattern in their souls."
"I suppose one can find a quote to justify anything," Magnus said.
"Look, I don't tattle to the Clave, whatever the warlocks of the Shadow Market might think to the contrary. But I've known Parabatai, dozens of them, what they're supposed to be like. And you and Emma are different. I can't imagine that if it hadn't been for the chaos of the Dark War, they would even have allowed you to go through with it. And now, because of a ceremony that was supposed to bind us forever, we have to figure out how to separate," Julian said bitterly. "We both know it. But with the riders out there..."
"Yes," said Magnus. "You are forced together for the moment."
Julian exhaled through his teeth. "Just confirm something for me," he said. "There's no such thing as a spell that cancels out love."
"There are a few temporary charms," said Magnus. "They don't last forever. Real love and the complexities of the human heart and brain are still beyond the tinkering of most magic. Maybe an angel or a greater demon."
"So Raziel could do it," said Julian.
I wouldn't hold your breath, said Magnus. Have you really looked all this up? Spells to cancel out love? Julian nodded. You are ruthless, said Magnus, even with yourself.
I thought Emma didn't love me anymore, said Julian. And she thought the same about me. Now we know the truth. It's not just that it's forbidden by the clave. It's cursed.
Magnus winced. I wondered if you knew about that.
Julian felt cold all over. No chance it was some kind of mistake of Jem's then. Not that he really thought it might be.
Jem told Emma. But he didn't say exactly how it worked, what would happen.
There was a slight tremor in Magnus's hand as he passed it over his eyes.
Look up the story of Silas Pangborn and Eloisa Ravenscar. There are other stories, too, though the Silent Brothers do their best to keep it quiet. His cat's eyes were bloodshot.
You go mad yourself first, he said. You become unrecognizable as a human being. And after you become a monster, you are no longer able to tell friend from enemy. As your family run toward you to save you, you will rip the hearts from their chests.
Julian felt as if he were going to throw up. That? I never hurt my family.
You won't know who they are, said Magnus. You won't know love from hate. And you'll destroy what's around you. Not because you want to, any more than a crashing wave wants to shatter the rocks it breaks on. He'll do it because you won't know not to.
He looked at Julian with an ancient sympathy.
It doesn't matter if your intentions are good or bad. It doesn't matter that love is a positive force. Magic doesn't take note of small human concerns.
I know, Julian said. But what can we do? I can't become a mundane or a downworlder and leave my family. It would kill me and them. And not being a shadow hunter anymore would be like suicide for Emma.
There is exile, Magnus said. His gaze was fathomless. You would still be shadow hunters, but you would be stripped of some of your magic. That's what exile means. That's the punishment. And because Parabatai magic is some of the most precious and most ingrained in what you are, exile deadens its power. All the things the curse intensifies, the power your runes give each other, the ability to feel what the other is feeling, or know if they're hurt, exile takes those away. If I understand magic, and I know I do, then that means exile would slow the curse down immeasurably.
And exile would also take me away from the children, said Julian in despair. I might never see them again. I might as well become a mundane. At least then I could try to sneak around and maybe watch them from a distance.
Bitterness corroded his voice. The terms of exile are determined by the Inquisitor and the Clave. It would be totally out of our control.
Not necessarily, said Magnus.
Julian looked at him sharply.
I think you'd better tell me what you mean.
That you have only one choice, and you won't like it.
Magnus paused, as if waiting for Julian to refuse to hear it, but Julian said nothing at all.
All right, said Magnus. When you get to Alicante, tell the Inquisitor everything.
Kit?
Something cool touched his temple, brushing back his hair. Shadows surrounded Kit, shadows in which he saw faces familiar and unfamiliar. The face of a woman with pale hair, her mouth forming the words of a song. His father's face, the angry countenance of Barnabas Hale. Ty looking at him through lashes as thick and black as the soot covering the London streets in the Dickens novel.
Kit.
The cool touch became a tap. His eyelids fluttered, and there was the ceiling of the infirmary in the London Institute. He recognized the strange tree-shaped burn on the plastered wall, the view of the rooftops through the window, the fan that spun its lazy blades over his head. And hovering over him, a pair of anxious blue-green eyes. Livy,
her long brown hair spilling down in tangled curls. She exhaled a relieved sigh as he frowned.
Sorry, she said. Magnus said to shake you awake every few hours or so, to make sure your concussion doesn't get worse.
Concussion? Kit remembered the rooftop, the rain, Gwyn, and Diana. A sky full of clouds sliding up and away as he fell. How did I wind up with a concussion? I was fine. It happens, apparently, she said. People get hit on the head. They don't realize it's serious until they pass out.
Ty?
He said. He started to sit up, which was a mistake. His skull ached as if someone had taken a bludgeon to it. Bits and pieces of memory flashed against the back of his eyes. The fairies in their terrifying bronze armor. The concrete platform by the river. The certainty that they were going to die.
Here.
Her hand curved around the back of his neck, supporting him. The rim of something cold clicked against his teeth.
Drink this.
Kit swallowed. Darkness came down, and the pain went away with it. He heard the singing again, down in the deepest part of everything he'd ever forgotten.
The story that I love you, it has no end.
When he opened his eyes again, the candle by his bed had guttered. There was light, though, in the room. Ty sat by the side of his bed, a witch light in his hand, looking up at the rotating blades of the fan. Kit coughed and sat up. This time it hurt a little less. His throat felt like sandpaper.
Water, he said.
Ty drew his gaze away from the fan blades. Kit had noticed before that he liked to look at them, as if their graceful motion pleased him. Ty found the water pitcher in a glass and handed it to Kit.
Do you want some more water? Ty asked when Kit's thirst had emptied the pitcher.
He'd changed clothes since Kit had seen him last. More of the odd, old-fashioned stuff from the storage room. Pinstriped shirt, black pants. He looked like he ought to be in an old advertisement.
Kit shook his head.
He held tightly to the glass in his hand. A strange sense of unreality had settled over him. Here he was, Kit Rook, in an institute, having gotten his head bashed in by large fairies for defending Nephilim. His father would have been ashamed, but Kit felt nothing but a sense of rightness, a sense that the peace that had always been missing from his life, that had made him anxious and uneasy, had returned to him by chance and fate.
Why did you do it?
Ty said. Kit propped himself up.
Why did I do what?
That time I came out of the magic shop and you and Livy were arguing. Ty's gray gaze rested on the point around Kit's collarbone. It was about me, wasn't it?
How'd you know we were arguing? Kit said. Did you hear us?
Ty shook his head. I know Livy, he said. I know when she's angry. I know things she does. She's my twin. I don't know those things about anyone else, but I know them about her. He shrugged. The argument was about me, wasn't it?
Kit nodded.
Everyone tries to protect me, said Ty. Julian tries to protect me from everything. Livy tries to protect me from being disappointed. She didn't want me to know that you might leave, but I've always known it. Jules and Livy, they have a hard time imagining that I've grown up, that I might understand some things are temporary.
You mean me, Kit said, that I'm temporary.
It's your choice to stay or leave, said Ty. In Limehouse, I thought maybe it would be leaving.
But what about you, said Kit. I thought you were going to the Scholomance, and I could never go there. I don't even have basic training.
Kit set his water glass down. Ty immediately picked it up and began turning it in his hands. It was made of milky glass, rough on the outside, and he seemed to like the texture. Ty was silent, and in that silence, Kit thought of Ty's headphones, the music in his ears, the whispered words, the way he touched things with such total concentration. Smooth stones, rough glass, silk and leather and textured linen. There were people in the world, he knew, who thought human beings like Ty did those things for no reason, because they were inexplicable, broken.
Kit felt a wash of rage go through him. How could they not understand? Everything Ty did had a reason. If an ambulance siren blared in your ears, you covered them. If something hit you, you doubled up to protect yourself from hurt. But not everyone felt and heard exactly the same way. Ty heard everything twice as loud and fast as everyone else. The headphones and the music, Kit sensed, were a buffer. They deadened not just other noises, but also feelings that would otherwise be too intense. They protected him from hurt. He couldn't help but wonder what it would be like to live so intensely, to feel things so much, to have the world sway into and out of two bright colors and two bright noises. When every sound and feeling was jacked up to 11, it only made sense to calm yourself by concentrating all your energy on something small that you could master. A mass of pipe cleaners to unravel, the pebbled surface of a glass between your fingers.
I don't want to tell you not to go to the Scholomance if that's what you want, said Kit. But I would just say that it isn't always about people trying to protect you or knowing what's best for you, or thinking they do. Sometimes they just know they'd miss you.
Livy would miss me. Your whole family would miss you, said Kit.
And I would miss you.
It was a bit like stepping off a cliff, far scarier than any con Kit had ever run for his dad, any downworlder or demon he'd ever met. Ty looked up in surprise, forgetting the glass in his hands. He was blushing. It was very visible against his pale skin.
You would?
Yeah, said Kit.
But like I said, I don't want to stop you from going if you want to.
I don't, said Ty. I changed my mind. He set the glass down. Not because of you, because the Scholomance appears to be full of assholes. Kit burst out laughing. Ty looked even more astonished than he had when Kit had said he'd miss him. But after a second, he started to laugh too. They were both laughing, Kit doubled up over the blankets, when Magnus came into the room. He looked at the two of them and shook his head.
Bedlam, he said, and went over to the counter where the glass tubes and funnels had been set up. He gave them a pleased look.
Not that anyone here probably cares, he said, but the antidote to the binding spell is ready. We should have no problem leaving for Idris tomorrow. Christina felt as if a tornado had blown through the room. She set her Bali song down on the mantle and turned to Mark. He was leaning against the wall, his eyes wide but not focused on anything. She remembered an old book she had read when she was a girl. There had been a boy in it whose eyes had been two different colors, a knight in the Crusades. One eye for God, the book had said, and one for the devil. A boy who had been split down the middle, part good and part evil, just as Mark was split between Fairy and Nephilim. She could see the battle raging in him now, though all his anger was for himself.
Mark, she began. It is not, don't say that it's not my fault, he said tonelessly.
I couldn't stand it, Christina.
It is not only your fault, said Christina. We all knew. It is all our fault. It was not the right thing to do, but we had very few choices. And Kieran did wrong you. I still shouldn't have lied to him.
A ragged dark crack across the plaster of Christina's wall bulged through the paint. It was the only sign of what happened. That and the crushed acorn on the hearth.
I am only saying that if you can forgive him, you should forgive yourself as well, she said.
Can you come here? Mark said in a strangled sort of voice. Mark had his eyes closed and was clenching and unclenching his hands. She nearly tripped getting to him across the room. He seemed to sense her approach. Without opening his eyes, he reached up for her and caught her hand in a bone-crushing grip. Christina glanced down. He held her hand so tightly it should have hurt, but all she saw was the red marks around both of their wrists. This close together, they had faded to almost nothing. She felt again what she had felt that night in the ballroom, as if the binding spell amplified their nearness into something else, a thing that dragged her mind back to that hill and Fairy, the memory of being wrapped up in Mark. Mark's mouth found hers. She heard him groan. He was kissing her, hard and desperately.
Her body felt as if fire was pouring through it, turning her light as ashes. Yet she could not forget Kieran kissing Mark in front of her, forceful and deliberate. It seemed she could not think of Mark now without thinking of Kieran, too. Could not see blue and gold eyes without seeing black and silver. Mark, she spoke against his lips. His hands were on her, stirring her blood to soft heat. This is not the right way to make yourself forget. He drew away from her. I want to hold you, he said. I want it very badly. He let go of her slowly, as if the motion were an effort. But it would not be fair. Not to you, or Kieran, or myself. Not now. Christina touched the back of his hand. You must go to Kieran and make things right between you. He is too important a part of you, Mark. You heard what the king said. Mark let his head fall back against the wall. He'll kill Kieran for testifying. He'll hunt him forever. That's our doing. He agreed to it. Without knowing the truth. He agreed to it because he thought he loved me, and I loved him. Isn't that true? Christina said. And even if it wasn't, he didn't just forget that you fought. He forgot what he did. He forgot what he owes. He forgot his own guilt. And that is part of why he's so angry. Not at you, but at himself. Mark's hand tightened on hers. We owe each other now, Kieran and I, he said. I have endangered him. The Unseelie King knows he plans to testify. He's sworn to hunt Kieran. Christina, what do we do? We try to keep him safe, Christina said. Whether he testifies or not, the king will forgive him. We need to find a place Kieran will be protected. Her chin jerked up as a realization hit her. I know exactly where. Mark, we must... There was a knock on the door. They stepped away from each other as it swung open. Both of them had expected it to be Kieran, and Mark's disappointment when it turned out to be Magnus was clear. Magnus was carrying two etched metal flasks and raised an eyebrow when he saw Mark's expression. I don't know who you were waiting for, but I'm sorry I'm not it, he said dryly. But the antidote is ready. Christina had expected a thrill of relief to go through her. Instead, she felt nothing. She touched her left hand to her sore wrist and glanced toward Mark, who was staring at the floor. Don't rush to thank me or anything, said Magnus, handing them each a flask. Profuse expressions of gratitude only embarrass me, though cash gifts are always welcome. Thank you, Magnus, Christina said, blushing. She unscrewed the flask. A dark and bitter scent wafted from it, like the smell of pulque, a drink that Christina had never liked. Magnus held up a hand. Wait until you're in separate rooms to drink it, he said. In fact, you should spend at least a few hours apart so that the spell can settle properly. All the effects should be gone by tomorrow. Thank you, said Mark, and headed for the door. He paused there and looked back at Christina. I agree with you, he said to her. About Kieran, if there's anything you can do to guarantee his safety, do it. He was gone noiselessly with cat-soft footsteps. Magnus glanced at the cracked wall and then at Christina. Do I want to know? He asked. Christina sighed. Can a fire message get outside the wards you put up? Magnus stared at the wall again, shook his head, and said, You'd better give it to me. I'll get it sent. She hesitated. I won't read it either, he said irritably. I promise. Christina set down her flask, found paper, pen, and steely, and scribbled the message with a rune signature before folding it and handing it to Magnus, who gave a low whistle when he saw the name of the recipient across the top. Are you sure? She nodded with a resolution she didn't feel. Absolutely. Chapter 27 Ill Angels Only. Emma, Julian rapped on her door with the back of his knuckles. At least he was fairly sure it was Emma's door. He'd never been inside her room at the London Institute. Emma, are you awake? I know it's late. He heard her call for him to come in, her voice muffled through the thick wooden door.
Inside, the room was much like his own, small with heavy blocks of Victorian-looking furniture. The bed was a solid four-poster with silk hangings. Emma was lying on the covers, wearing an overwashed T-shirt and pajama bottoms. She rolled onto her side and grinned at him. An overwhelming feeling of love hit him like a punch to the chest. Her hair was tied messily back, and she was lying on a rumpled blanket with a plate of pastries next to her. And he had to stop in the middle of the room for a moment to catch his breath. She waved a tart at him, cheerily. "Ben Offee," she said. "Want some?" He could have crossed the room in a few steps. Could have picked her up and swung her into his arms and held her. Could have told her how much he loved her. If they were any other couple, it would be that easy. But nothing for them would ever be easy. She was looking at him in puzzlement. "Is everything all right?" He nodded, a little surprised at his own feelings. Usually he kept better control over himself. Maybe it was the conversation he'd had with Magnus. Maybe it had given him hope. If there was one thing Julian's life had taught him, it was that nothing was more dangerous than hope. "Julian," she said, setting the tart down and brushing the crumbs off her hands, "would you please say something?" He cleared his throat. "We need to talk." She groaned and flopped back against her pillows. "Okay, not that." Julian sat down on the foot of her bed as she cleared off the covers, setting aside the food and a few things she'd been looking at. He saw an old photograph of a girl carrying a blade that looked like Cortana, and another one of four boys in Edwardian clothes by the side of a river. When she was done, she brushed off her hands again and turned a set face to his.
"How soon do we have to separate?" she said. Her voice was shaking a little. "As soon as the meeting is over in Alicante? What will we tell the kids?"
"I talked to Magnus," Julian said. "He said we should go to the Inquisitor."
Emma made an incredulous noise. "The Inquisitor? As in the council leader who enforces laws?"
"Pretty sure Magnus knows who the Inquisitor is," said Julian. "He's Alec's dad."
"Did he mean that as a sort of threat? Like, either we turn ourselves into Robert Lightwood, or he does it for us? But Magnus wouldn't. I can't see him doing that. He's much too loyal."
"That's not it," Julian said. "Magnus wants to help us. He remembers other Parabatai like us, and he pointed out that no Parabatai have ever gone to the Clave for help."
"Because it's the Clave's law."
"But that's not the problem," said Julian. "We could handle the law. It's the curse which is the reason the law exists, even if the Clave doesn't know it. But we know it."
Emma only looked at him. "Every other Parabatai have feared the law more than the curse," Julian said. "They've always either separated, left the Clave, or hidden what was happening to them until they were caught or the curse killed them. Magnus said we'd be the first, and that would count for something with Robert. And he pointed out something else, too. Robert was exiled because he was in the Circle years ago. The exile temporarily suspended his bond with his Parabatai. Magnus said Alec told him about it, that it cut their bond enough that Robert didn't even realize his Parabatai was dead."
"Exile?" Emma's voice shook.
"Exile means the Clave sends you away. You have no choice about it."
"But the Inquisitor is one who chooses the terms of the exile," said Julian.
"Robert is the one who decided Aline could stay with Helen when she was exiled. The Clave was against it."
"If one of us is to be exiled, it'll be me," said Emma. "I'll go be with Christina in Mexico. You're indispensable to the children. I'm not."
Her voice was firm, but her eyes were glimmering with tears. Julian sensed the same wave of desperate love he felt before, threatening to overwhelm him, and forced it back.
"I hate the idea of being separated, too," Julian said, running his hand over the blanket, the rough texture comforting against his fingers. "The way I love you is fundamental to me, Emma. So I am, no matter how far we are from each other."
The glimmer in her eyes became liquid. A tear spilled down her cheek. She didn't move to wipe it away.
"Then?"
"Exile will deaden the bond," he said. He tried to keep his voice steady.
There was still a part of him that hated the idea of not being Emma's Parabatai, despite everything, and hated the thought of exile, too. Magnus is sure of it. Exile will do something separation can't, Emma, because exile is deep shadow hunter enchantment. The ceremony of exile lessens some of your Nephilim abilities, your magic, and having a Parabatai is part of that magic. It means the curse will be postponed. It means we can have time, and I can stay with the kids. I'd have to leave them otherwise. The curse doesn't just hurt us, Emma. It hurts the people around us. I can't stay near the kids thinking I might be some kind of threat to them. She nodded slowly. So if it gives us time, then what? Magnus has promised to bring everything he has to bear on figuring out how to break the bond, or end the curse, one or the other. Emma raised her hand to rub at her wet cheek, and he saw the long scar on her forearm that had been there since he'd handed her Cortana in a room in Alicante 5 years ago. How we have left our marks on each other, he thought.
I hate this, she whispered. I hate the idea of being away from you and the kids.
He wanted to take her hand, but held himself back. If he let himself touch her, he might crumble and fall apart, and he had to stay strong and reasonable and hopeful. He was the one who'd listened to Magnus, who'd agreed to this, and it was on him. I hate it too, he said. If there was any way it could be me going into exile, I would do it, Emma. Look, we'll only agree to do it if the terms are what we want, if the exile period is short, if you can live with Christina, if the Inquisitor promises no dishonor will accrue to your family name. Magnus really thinks Robert Lightwood is going to be that willing to help us? To basically let us dictate the terms of our exile? He really does, said Julian. He didn't say why exactly. Maybe because Robert was exiled himself once, or because his Parabatai died.
But Robert doesn't know about the curse.
And he doesn't need to, said Julian. Just being in love breaks the law long before the curse is triggered. And the law says we'll have to be separated or have our marks stripped away. That's not good for the Clave. They're hurting for shadow hunters, certainly ones as good as you. He'll want a solution that keeps you Nephilim pretty badly. And besides, we have leverage. What leverage? Julian drew in a long breath.
We know how to cut the bond. We've been acting like we don't, but we do.
Emma went rigid all over.
Because we can't even consider the idea, she said. It's not something we could ever do.
It still exists, Julian said. We still know about it. Her hand shot out and grabbed the front of his shirt. Her grip was incredibly strong.
Julian, she said, it would be an unforgivable sin to use whatever magic it is the Seelie Queen was talking about. We wouldn't just be hurting Jason, Alec, Clary, and Simon, all the people we don't know that we'd be harming, destroying this thing that's as fundamental to them as how you love me and I love you.
They're not us, Julian said. This isn't just about you and me. This is about the children, about my family, our family.
Jules. The dismay in her eyes was stark. I've always known you'd do anything for the kids. We've always said we both would. But when we talk about anything, we still mean there are things we wouldn't do. Don't you know that?
Julian, you scared me. Yes, I know that, he said, and she relaxed slightly. Her eyes were wide. He wanted to kiss her even more than he had before, partly because she was Emma, and that meant she was good and honest and thoughtful. Ironic, really. It's just a threat, he added. Leverage. We wouldn't do it, but Robert doesn't need to know that. Emma let go of his shirt.
It's too much of a threat, she said. Destroying Parabatai as a thing that exists could rip the whole fabric of Nephilim apart.
We're not going to destroy anything. He took her face in his hands. Her skin was soft against his palms. We're going to fix it all. We're going to be together. Exile will give us the time we need
to find out how to break the bond. If it could be done the Sealy Queen's way, it can be done some other way. The curse was like a monster at our heels. This gives us breathing room. She kissed his palm. You sound so sure.
I am sure, he said. Emma, I am totally sure.
He couldn't stand it any longer. He pulled her into his lap. She felt her weight fall against his body, her face pressed against the crook of his neck. Her hand traced the collar of his t-shirt just where the skin touched the cotton.
Do you know why I'm sure? He whispered, kissing her temple, her cheek, where it tasted like salt. Because when this universe was born, when it blasted into existence in fire and glory, everything that would ever exist was created. Our souls are made of that fire and glory, of the atoms of it, the fragments of stars. Everyone's are, but I believe ours, yours and mine, are made of the dust of the same star. That's why we've always been drawn to each other like magnets all our lives. All the pieces of us belong together. He held her tighter. Your name, Emma, means universe, you know, he said. Doesn't that prove I'm right?
She gave a sobbing half-laugh, lifted her face, and kissed him hard. His body jumped as if he'd touched an electrified wire. His mind went blank, just the sound of their breathing in his ears, and the feel of her hands on his shoulders, and the taste of her mouth. He couldn't stand it. Holding her, he rolled sideways, taking her with him so they lay crossways on the coverlet. His hands moved under her oversized shirt, cupping her waist, thumbs tracing the angles of her hips. They were still kissing,